inside my head. I'll take a day off, I'll be dead. My icy fingers claw your back. Here I come again.
WRIF's award-winning Night Call, Detroit's longest-running phone-in talk show with Peter Werby and Jolene Jordan. Peter and Jolene will be voicing their opinions, and they want to hear yours. Call them at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Now, here are Peter and Jolene.
Thank you very much, and hi, Jolene.
Hi, Peter.
Another great week, and man, is it nice out.
It is nice out.
It's beautiful out. About a quarter moon, warm, the breeze is blowing.
Depends on where you are.
Yeah, I suppose. We're in Detroit, Michigan. You could be anywhere in the world. In fact, I got an email from, he listens on our podcast, from David, living in Longmont, Colorado now.
Nice.
And yeah, he left Detroit, and, you know, you can take the boy out of Detroit, but you can't take Detroit out of the boy.
You just can't do it. Or the girl.
Yeah. Well, you know, it was generic.
Right.
Yeah,
okay.
The way they used to say man when they met everybody.
Yeah, man.
But, hey, this is a phone-in talk show. Our phone numbers are 313-298-WRIF.
313-298-9743.
You can go to our email. Get us a message like that. Call talkyes@yahoo.com. And if you're just listening for the first time, you're probably thinking, what the hell are they talking about? Well, we're going to be talking about everything. You can talk about anything. It's what we call Open Line Sundays. Of course, we only do this on Sundays. The rest of the week, the other
we're rocking.
20, I can't do the math even, but it's rocking. Yeah.
Rocking hard.
This is Detroit's most progressive political talk show, standing for peace and social and economic justice. I say that because that P.O. is some well-known
folks.
Yeah.
Well, I P.O.'d a couple off on Facebook just by joking around that we were going to have a little contest. Are the Clintons or the Palins more dysfunctional? Which we'll get to. And,
yeah.
And I mean, this Republican that I used to work with in Iowa, hey, if you're listening, Mary, hi. She said it sounds like a waste of the airwaves. And I go, you know, Republicans really have no sense of humor.
Yeah, they do. Or,
it's so sad. We laugh all day and night.
Or sense of decency.
Thank you very much, Peter.
Congratulations to everybody who put on Detroit's 18th Annual Diversity Festival, The Concert of Colors. Mavis Staples took the stage tonight. She's the old Staples singer. But there was a Don Was Detroit All-Stars who just put up any number. Let me see. Alberta Adams, who's 93 or 94
is
years old.
Is she really?
Old blues singer.
Ooh.
And she brought the house down. They had to put her in. She couldn't stand even. And
right.
But she sang her signature song, Detroit's My Home.
I love it.
Busted the place up. Dennis Coffey, the amazing funk brother from Motown, still plays around. Marshall Crenshaw. I know Marshall's brother, Robert, who's the drummer. Lives in our neighborhood, right?
Yeah.
Who the Electric Lion Soundwave Experiment did psychedelic rock. They were absolutely terrific.
Groovy.
Let's see. The Motor City Horns, who on occasion has backed up Bob Seger. This was all for free, by the way. This was Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. The Detroit Symphony Orchestra played on two different occasions. Outrageous Cherry were the Sun Messengers and the old Motowner Kim Weston, who did a lot of, she brought the house down as well. The Satin Peaches, it was a terrific show.
I love the name of that band.
Yeah, yeah. The basics, let's see, the Codgers doing Irish music. And this is music from all over the world. Red Barat, which was an all-brass band that apparently brought the house down as well. The Southwest Detroit Latin Super Session. So it was great. So I tell you about these things, people. I put them on my website, and the majority of you ignore them. I mean, it's your choice, but I'm telling you, folks, you're missing lots of good
stuff. There's a lot of free stuff to do.
Yeah, that was all free, too.
Hard economic times.
Absolutely.
Nice.
Which, unfortunately, we're going to get to. But some good news. What? They've capped the Gulf oil well?
Do you believe them?
Well, there is apparently now a big flap going on because BP, these corporate criminals, and the Obama administration are giving differing views on whether the capped Gulf of Mexico oil well will have to be reopened. A contradiction that may be an effort by the oil giant to avoid blame if crude starts spewing again. So they capped it. This just came in, and the government's plan is to eventually pipe oil to the surface, which would ease pressure on the fragile well, but would require up to 3 more days of oil spilling into the Gulf. Whatever. Hey, man, it's been going on for 3 months. That could be the Dead Sea. Oh, they already have something called that, don't they? Well, this could be the Dead Gulf. And I don't mean to sound cynical. This is, as everybody's been saying, an occurrence of ecological catastrophe. There are oil spills that have occurred, and that's part of oil drilling and use and all the rest of it is just ecological disasters. I mean, at every level, you've heard me say this before, when it's drilled, we're talking about usually when it's on land, but on the sea as well, there's been spill after spill after spill. And some regions 30 years later are still suffering ecological damage. Well, the Earth can only take so much. Well, let me put it this way. The Earth can take absolutely anything, but the forms of life will alter.
Yeah, absolutely. On my way here, there was a senator, and I didn't catch who it was who was talking about drilling in the Great Lakes.
Sure,
oh,
why not?
Come on.
Yeah.
I mean,
I don't think this is going to happen. But let me see. And also, let me see what's in this little packet, which says oil is shut off. Oh, yeah. Owner of exploded rig is known for testing rules.
Is that what they're calling it?
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. In other words, pushing the envelope as far as you can.
Right.
But it's worse than that. Deepwater Horizon, their rig exploded in April. And very few people heard of them. But human rights advocates have called for an investigation into Transocean's. The name of the company is Transocean. It's Deepwater Horizon Rig. Human rights advocates have called for an investigation in Transocean's recent dealings with Myanmar. That's what was Burma. The site is, they cite its involvement in a drilling project that apparently included a company that is suspected of having ties to two men accused of laundering money for the country's repressive government, which is under United States sanction. Transocean has disclosed in Securities and Exchange Commission filing that its drilling equipment was shipped by a forwarder through Iran, and that until last year it held a stake in a company that did business in Syria. State Department says Syria and Iran sponsored terrorism. So this is BP's partner. This is the people that were cutting the corners that are responsible for all of this. In Norway, Transocean is the subject of a criminal investigation into a possible tax fraud. The company has said in filings that Norwegian officials could assess it about $840 million in taxes and penalties. In the U.S., a federal bankruptcy judge recently found that one of Transocean's merger partners had repeatedly abused the legal system to try to avoid potential liability. In a pollution case in Louisiana, Transocean is also the target of tax inquiries in the United States and Brazil.
Ah.
This is the corporate elite, folks. This is the
and the corporate elite that's been going on without anyone knowing that the name Transocean until maybe right now.
And only guys can get this. I know here the women can have a part of the anatomy a little farther up in the body, but the men, it's like they just got you and they just squeezing. They're just squeezing, you know, and they don't care.
Ouch.
There are 27,000 abandoned oil and gas wells in the Gulf of Mexico as it is, and no action is being taken from keeping them leaking even more crude into water. That keeps it. BP is pursuing Alaska drilling that some call risky. I like always these headlines.
Yeah.
Here. Yeah, so they're doing it in Alaska as well. And at the same time, of course, I think many of you know this. I mean, this is not, you know, like secret news that I get from. Can you take the lines off a hold?
Yeah, that would be good.
Yeah. If you want to call in, 313-298.
A little details.
WRIF. You've been trying to call.
Talk show.
Yeah, you can do it now. So it's 313-298-WRIF. When the Deepwater Horizon drilling platform set off the worst oil spill at sea in American history, it was flying the flag of the Marshall Islands. Makes sense, right? Registering there allowed the rig's owner to significantly reduce its American taxes.
Wow.
So it's...
How surprising, really.
Destroying this fragile, and everything in nature is fragile. I mean, that's why there's been so much destruction, because we hurt it so badly, and it's so easily injured. There is a capacity for nature to restore itself. Like, for instance, they used to say about nuclear war, that if it occurred, it would end life on Earth. Well, it might end all of us.
It might end a lot of life.
It might end all the megafauna, right, without a doubt. But, hey, there are a lot of creatures that aren't even going to be affected by it. But we'd like to keep things at least somewhat as they are in terms of our, you know, continuation on the planet. Let's see. The owner, Transocean, again, moved its corporate headquarters from Houston to the Cayman Islands in 1999 and to Switzerland in 2008.
How convenient.
I mean, these people are corporate criminals. Why are they not in jail?
They have five-hour meetings to figure out how, you know, where they're going to go and how they're going to get around everything, yeah. And, you know, daily.
At the same time, BP was reaping sizable tax benefits from leasing the rig. According to a letter sent in June to the Senate Finance Committee, the company used a tax break for the oil industry to write off 70% of the rent for Deepwater Horizon, a deduction of more than $225,000 a day. And they didn't put in that $500,000 little piece of machinery that could have stopped all of this.
Oh, yeah.
So 2 days.
I wonder if they've ordered that for future use yet.
Probably not.
Mm.
With federal officials now considering a new tax on petroleum production to pay for the cleanup, the industry is fighting the measure, warning that it will lead to job losses and higher gasoline prices, as well as increased dependence on foreign oil. And again, we always say, folks, it's capitalist blackmail. Do you want us to keep screwing you and the environment, or do you want to lose your job? Which do you want?
Right.
But an examination of the American tax code indicates that oil production is among the most heavily subsidized businesses, with tax breaks available at virtually every stage of exploration and extraction process. And so it's pretty much murder incorporated, right, on one hand, and so much for the free market. Now, there are some libertarians that are actually serious about the free market. Their ideas are crazy as well, because this would mean no regulation on these people. But on the other hand, the Republicans, who are a joke when it comes to the free market, remember, there's only one thing they want governed by the free market, and that's our labor. Remember, they were the people that fought tooth and nail against the minimum wage back in the 1930s. And they have fought every single raise in the minimum wage since, because they're saying, oh, it will lose jobs. So do you want to keep getting crappy wages, or do you want to lose your job? I mean, always blackmail. It's always blackmail. 313-298-WRIF. You know, I've got... I don't even know if I can deal with this one. I mean, it is such bad news. Maybe we should go on to the fun. Let me say one thing here.
Maybe you should get the bad out of the way.
Nah. Let's go.
Just spike it in there.
Let's go to from your home state. In fact, your hometown, Des Moines.
Yes.
This Iowa Tea Party group on Wednesday replaced a billboard comparing President Barack Obama to Adolf Hitler and Vladimir Lenin, calling the sign a bad decision that reflected poorly on the organization.
There's a lot of infighting going on with the baggers these days.
Yeah, the baggers.
You
the tea baggers are, they could implode.
So what do you think about this billboard?
I couldn't care less. You know?
Really?
Yeah. I mean, here, the roughly 200-member Tea Party group had the original sign put up last week. It showed photographs of Obama, Nazi leader Hitler, and communist leader Lenin beneath the labels Oh, this is really interesting. Democrat socialism. I misread this before. National socialism and Marxist socialism. Now, I just heard, oh, who remembers this? Somebody else must have listened to the, oh, yeah, that's right. This whole idea that these bizarros, these weird whack jobs in the Republican Party, they refer to the Democratic Party as the Democrat Party.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Yeah. And no one could ever figure out why.
Right.
And apparently it goes back to the days of this crazed, drunken senator, Joseph McCarthy, who called everybody a communist, and he referred to the Democratic Party as the Democrat Party because he said it had rat in it.
Right, yeah.
Yeah. You've heard that?
I have heard that before.
Oh, okay. I never did.
Well, I thought we've talked about it before.
I forget that.
Yeah, well, it's been a lot of years of talk radio.
Yeah, right. And and also, other people have said they don't want it, they don't want the word democratic to be associated with the Democratic Party. Whatever.
Yeah, seriously.
I mean, who other than, you know, I didn't even notice this. I mean, a few Democrats went crazy when they, when, some point a couple of years ago, the Republicans started referring to the Democratic Party as the Democrat Party again.
Yeah.
I didn't even think anything about it, you know, like, but they got all whacked up.
Well, I mean, okay, the billboard's just a little over the top. I mean, if they're really comparing Obama, I mean, they've just taken it a little far.
You know,
I could care less about the thing, but...
You can go to my website, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E.com, and somewhere in there, oh yeah, I think it's on the right side, you go down and there's a photograph of Bush as a vampire sucking the neck of the Statue of Liberty.
Yeah, which is right? Why we can't criticize these things too terribly much.
So, and if you click on that, it, you know, it says the Bush crime family, never forgive, never forget.
Yeah.
And you go there to that portion of my site, that page, the Bush crime family page, and it's just replete with Bush as Hitler.
So there you go.
You want to call Obama?
But that's your website. You didn't have a billboard made out of it.
Oh, if I would have had money, I would have. Pardon me. Now, this kind of took it away from me. All right. So Hitler was, in fact, talk about National Socialism, which, of course, was a ruse because he was being paid off by the big corporate interests, and that's who financed him, essentially. Marxist Socialism, okay, that was Lenin. And I thought it said Democratic Socialism. Democratic Socialism is the phrase that they use for the social plans, the social benefits that are, you know, available in all the other industrial countries of the world. And so that you would call like a national health plan that they have in Canada and Sweden, Norway and France and Italy and everywhere else, democratic socialism. See, so I don't know. Didn't bother me, but it, I guess the teabaggers got all upset.
Yeah.
Also, the teabaggers are all upset because the NAACP said that they were a racist organization and they got defended.
Yeah.
By? Joe Biden.
Yeah.
He says neither he nor President Obama believes the Tea Party is a racist organization. I agree. It's not a racist. It's filled with racists.
It's filled with racists. Come on. Right?
Yeah. But it's not a racist organization.
Well, maybe it didn't start out to be.
I don't think it doesn't have any. It doesn't have any platform or programs or anything that's explicitly racist. And you would even have to go a ways for to find it to be implicit.
Maybe not a platform, but you go to the rallies and those signs are definitely racist.
Well, there's a lot of, I went to Google and you go to the, and you write racist, Tea Party racist signs and go to images.
And there you
and
go.
They're there. Yeah.
Have a great time.
Yeah. All of the racists in this country, unless they're in these little small parties, but the majority of white racists in this country are Republicans, and a great numbers of them are teabaggers.
Yes, I would agree with that.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, people don't admit that anymore. It's not fashionable to say, yes, I'm a racist, the way they used to.
Who would admit that? Well, someone in the KKK.
Yeah.
Proudly.
Yeah. Actually, there's a guy, I thought I printed it out. There's a guy who is leading the anti-immigrant patrolling in the Arizona desert.
Oh, yeah.
Who's a neo-Nazi.
Yes.
Yeah. And
I read that.
I wonder if he says he's a racist or not.
Well, that's a good question.
Yeah, that's part of their deal, isn't it? 313-298-WRF. You want to? All right, here's two weddings. One very, very secretive.
Yes, one. Oh, yes. Chelsea Clinton.
Yeah. Yeah.
And what a big to-do. And, oh, my gosh, the guest list. It's. I mean, this
everything's
is,
secret.
Oh, yeah. But it's big stuff. I mean, it's a big, huge, fancy, you know, the heavy hitters will be there.
If the Clintons had their way, if, I don't know about the parents, but if Chelsea had her way, probably nobody would know about it at all because they're keeping it mega secret. And everywhere she goes, she keeps it very secret. Article in the New York Times talks about how at just a luncheon with Chelsea and some of her friends, in fact, they refer to her as the publicity-shy daughter of the former president. In other words, she'd like to be a human being. She, by virtue of birth, right? She doesn't want to be...
And her brains.
Yeah.
And not be on a reality TV show.
She doesn't want to be a freak. She doesn't want it everywhere, you know, if she farts. She doesn't want that on, you know, reported on television.
Remember, she got beat up pretty bad when she went through her ugly phase, you know, the teenage phase where you have zits and all of that. Remember
The right wingers.
Rush Limbaugh beat up on her pretty bad. Yeah.
Him? I mean, what about the old idea of, do unto others or pot calling the kettle black, right?
Yeah, no kidding.
I don't get it.
How that guy gets a hot babe, I have no idea. They must be the dumbest women in the world.
Well, how many times has he been divorced?
Cha-ching.
Cha-ching, cha-ching.
Cha-ching. And then they just hold their breath and close their eyes and think of other things. You know what I'm saying? Put a bag on it, Rush.
Yeah, well, I don't know. He's not doing drugs anymore, is he?
Oh, who knows?
You know, because you're doing a lot of OxyContin.
He did more of that than the entire Beaumont Hospital, I think.
So. Well, Chelsea's wedding is set for July 31st. We only know it's cloaked in secrecy. And where the mother of the bride holds on a day job running international diplomacy for President Obama. That would be Hillary.
That would be.
Hello.
Remember her?
Yeah. And Dad. Now, on the other side, on the cheap, tawdry, I don't know what to say.
It's a little bit white trash.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
Yeah. Wow. That would be...
Bristol Palin.
And
Bristol and Levi are together again.
Together again. How do we know?
Oh, could it be that 8-page spread in Us Weekly?
That they called them and say, and now on the front cover it says, we're engaged.
Did you see the picture?
I did see it online. And they got a little trip.
They have whatever, trig, track,
trig.
Train.
Trig, yeah. Or is it? Wait a minute, which is it?
I don't know.
This is important. Let's see.
Is it?
Trip. It is Trip.
Okay.
There is a Trig somewhere along. I think Trig is her kid, the one with Down syndrome.
Yes.
Yeah. That's right. But
and they didn't tell Sarah. They just announced it.
Yeah.
And they're shopping reality shows. So this is like really night and day.
Well, here, on this incredible... Gail Collins' column from the New York Times, The Bad News Bears, Bristol and Levi are getting together again. Let me go out on a limb, says Gail Collins, and say that Sarah Palin was probably not happy to learn about her oldest daughter's reengagement to her baby daddy via an 8-page cover spread in Us magazine. Bristol confided, hopefully she will jump on board. Yeah.
Oh, it's so funny.
Bristol, who followed up her Us Weekly appearance with People magazine interview, agreed that before her mother will come around,
this is pretty funny.
Levi would, quote, have to get his education and a job and be willing to support Trip the right way.
The wrong way was probably that playgirl.
Yeah, but don't you think that he was trying to make a name for himself? Remember, he was going around saying that that Sarah had made him shave off his mullet before they appeared at the Republican National Convention.
And he also accused her, and this is so bad that I hate him and repeat it, but he said it. Levi said about Sarah that she called her baby, where's my little retarded baby? He said that in an interview.
And he also said she can't shoot worth a damn. Really? He said all this stuff. He said they're always that Sarah and what's hubby? That's Hubby's name? Todd. Todd. That they're always fighting. This can't be. Here is the weirdest thing of all. 76% of Republicans give her high marks. I mean, that's
Are
how.
Are you serious?
Yeah. That's how far down the drain this country is.
I am so scared right now.
There was a guy named Eisenhower, for instance, you know. Were there any other good Republicans? Must have been some. Oh, Lincoln.
Yeah, okay. He did some real important stuff.
Sarah Palin was wearing the mantle of Lincoln, talking about where Mama Grizzlies.
Oh, yeah. What is the Mama Grizzly video? She made a video.
Moms kind of just know when something's wrong. This is what passes for politics, folks, in the U.S. of A.
Shameful.
This is very pathetic.
At best.
Since Sarah Palin's own fame seems grounded on a little but a look and an attitude, you know, that wink, you can't blame the kids for thinking the same kind of thing would work for them. Bristol tried to become a celebrity unwed mother. The anti-teen pregnancy spokeswoman for a sexy clothing line. I love that. Levi tried to make a name for himself as a celebrity unwed mother's ex-boyfriend. It might have worked out, except that that as a spokesman, Bristol turned out to have nothing to say, and Levi, who kept showing up on TV promising to tell my side of the story, was close to subverbal.
That's because he's so dumb. He doesn't have anything coherent to say, Peter. He really is.
Tripp's middle name is Easton, which is, they named him that because that is Levi's favorite hockey equipment company.
Oh, God.
These people are so bad. How can they exist?
I'm scratching and shaking my head at the same time.
This is...
Oh, my gosh, Peter.
I don't know. What does this one say?
I liked when he went on the... You know Kathy Griffin, the comedian?
Yeah, sure.
She took him to some kind of awards show, and she said that they were dating, which is one of her shticks, you know? And it was fabulous. He really is dumb. He needs their money.
Yeah, what's this about a reality show? What would this do for Sarah Palin's presidential stuff? Oh, yeah. The U.S. Weekly interview was conducted in secret last weekend in Anchorage, said Melanie Bromley, the magazine's West Coast bureau chief. She said that the couple had approached the publication. So here are these people. Here's Chelsea hiding out thinking, could we get these people away from me so I can live on my own?
A real meaningful wedding?
Yeah, and I can be a real person. She said the couple had approached the publication that Bristol Palin had said her mother did not know about the marriage plans. She declined to comment on reports that the magazine had paid for the story. So,
well, you know that they've made.
Yeah. So Levi is thinking she's a money honey for him.
Absolutely.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
All right.
Now I'm waiting for the first phone call to say, why are you two talking about this stupid topic?
Well, you know what? I'll tell you why we're talking about this stupid topic and these absolutely stupid people. That you can imagine that the Republican spokesperson, the person, as much as I dislike people like William Buckley and Barry Goldwater, people like that, and they're replaced by by a wink, by someone who talks about Mama Grizzlies. This is such a pathetic state of affairs that I can't, politically, that I can't even believe it.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Jolene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Peter and Jolene are taking your calls at 313-298-WRIF.
That's what we do.
We'll be taking more of your calls right after this.
That's the sound of people throwing out their old dehumidifiers. They've replaced them with the energy-saving Wave Ventilation Unit. Wave Ventilation expels moisture, gases, and toxins trapped in your basement or crawl space and replaces it with drier, fresher air. The computerized Wave Ventilation requires no maintenance. There are no buckets to empty, no filters to change, and compared to a dehumidifier, it will save you hundreds of dollars a year in energy costs. One customer wrote,
I was stunned by the difference. I had a dehumidifier for almost 20 years without ever getting rid of that musty smell. And now that smell is finally gone.
Wave can transform your home into a drier, healthier environment. Satisfaction guaranteed. Find out more about Wave Ventilation right now.
For free information, go to goodairnow.com. That's goodairnow.com. Or call 1-866-324-9481. That's 1-866-324-9481.
We're back with more Night Call. 101 WRIF. Voice your opinion at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Here are Peter and Julie.
That was a quick one.
That was. we're back.
We're scrambling for our headphones. All right. Have you got something more important to talk about than the two of them?
How about Mel Gibson?
Mel Gibson. Somebody wants to talk about Mel Gibson. We can start with him. It's Mike. Mike in Birmingham. Hey, Mike, you're on the air. You're our first caller. Welcome.
Hi, this is Mike Gibson. Yeah, I'd like to talk about Mel Gibson, that jerkwad.
Oh, he's...
Wait a minute. You have the same last name?
I have the same last name, yes, and I'm embarrassed and ashamed to have the same last name as that jerk.
There's a lot of good Gibsons.
I'm sick of people comparing me, asking me if I'm related to him. I'm not related to him. If I was, I'd change my last name.
No kidding.
Wow. Yeah, he's...
It's like being a Palin.
Hey, but Mel Gibson, who was born in Australia, says he's going back. He sold one of his mansions in New York.
Bye-bye.
As we say in Detroit, adios, MF.
Yeah.
I say good riddance, Mel. Get the hell out of this.
Yeah.
I've never, ever liked that guy. And I have a pretty good instinct.
I always did.
I never liked him. I thought to myself, you know what? I think my instincts were really on him with this guy because he's proven himself. Just a complete, you know, racist, bigot, all of it.
Yeah, I mean, he is just opened up on everyone, right? Jews, blacks, women,
everybody.
Hispanics,
yeah.
At some point. And
did you happen to hear Reverend Ted Haggard was on the Joy Behar show talking about Mel Gibson saying, oh, he needs our love and support, he needs forgiveness, he needs prayer from God, we should have compassion and mercy on him, yeah.
Yeah, well,
yeah,
that's...
He's
been a supporter of Mel Gibson, and in fact, during...
You got that quote from Frank Rich. This was a few years ago when that Passion of the Christ came out, that weird, what does he call it, homoerotic, sadomasochistic film.
I never saw it.
Are you serious?
I was married at the time, and my mother-in-law was big-time Christian, and she said it so matter-of-factly, have you seen The Passion yet? And I'm like, no. And, you know, they were trying to convince me to go, and I thought, there's no way. That's like getting me inside of a church. It's hard to get me in for one for a wedding. Anyhow, back when Gibson, Mel Gibson went on the Jewish, anti-Jewish mode to the cops, it was Ted Haggard who said that we needed to, what did he say, that the Jewish leaders would be short-sighted to risk alienating 2 billion Christians over a movie. Oh, that was over the
Passion. $2 billion,
that was over the Passion. But it was Ted Haggard who then turned around and had himself a little male prostitute and a little crack habit.
Yeah, right. And Ted Haggard,
he's healed.
He's healed.
He's not gay anymore.
So, didn't he say that he didn't have any sex with the male prostitute he was in the room with doing crack?
I think he tried to convince us of that.
And he wasn't doing any crack either.
Yeah, right. He was just watching.
All right, Mike, not to be confused. Look, there's been a lot of good Gibsons. Think about that first baseman for Detroit and all that as well.
Don't let Mel ruin it for all of
you. Right. So, here's Kevin in Detroit. Kevin, hi, it's Peter and Jalene. Hey, thanks for joining us on WRIF. Now it's your turn. Go ahead.
Hi. How you guys doing?
We're good.
Let me ask you something, Pete and Jalene. Don't you remember during the Republican convention that Giuliani and Newt Gingrich all stood up and gave Sarah Palin's daughter a standing ovation because she was going to keep her baby?
Yeah.
Now, let me ask you guys this. Now, Barack Obama's daughters were of age, let's say teen, and had a baby. Now, do you honestly think these guys would have been doing that or they've been scolded and black out of wedlock birth?
You're absolutely right.
What do you think? I know that.
I'm just saying, just to hear how big a hypocrite these guys are.
Yeah.
I mean, but Pete, you said it earlier. People, Sean Hannity the other night said that, oh, Sarah Palin, I'll vote for her in a heartbeat. I think she's brilliant. I think she'll be a great president. I said, dude, is this guy serious? Now, no matter what you may think of Barack Obama, I mean, you cannot tell me that Sarah Palin is presidential material
No.
One house.
Well, you know what? I think the Democrats...
Maybe the PTA.
Yeah, well, she'd probably quit halfway through her term. But, you know, Kevin, I suspect the Democrats probably hope and hope and hope that they nominate her.
Yeah, for sure.
Because she'll be the easiest to beat. I mean, can you imagine?
She just... There's no possibility she can get any smarter because she's reached her limit.
Right.
And
she was like George Bush. Yeah. So can you imagine a debate between Barack Obama and Sarah Palin? I mean, it's just inconceivable. All right, Kevin, thanks for calling into 313-298-WRIF. There are some open lines. Please grab them, and let's hear from you. Here's Blake. Blake's in Detroit as well. Go ahead, Blake. You're on the air.
Hey, guys. How you doing?
We're good.
I listen to your show all the time because I never sleep.
Oh, boy.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Insomniac?
No, I'm just always working. I was going to touch on the oil spill.
Yeah, sure. Very
my important. Family, we manufacture springs. We've been around for about 65 years in Detroit.
Wait a minute. You're not the limp in, leap out people, are you?
No. We're hide, spring, and wire.
Okay, good.
And I got... Was it like less than a month ago? I got this quote in for they wanted 150,000 springs, and it was for the booms that they're putting on the oil spill down in New Orleans and in the Gulf.
Really?
And they said, you know, this is a great opportunity, and because it's government money, it comes across real quick. But the thing is, it's, you know, there's got to be 500 spring companies between the Gulf and me. And, yeah, I'm happy to get the work because my guy's got to eat too. But it's just another one of these things where everyone promises, oh, and we're doing everything local, and we're going to take care of everyone. And you're going as far as possible up north to find somebody to provide more. And you see this every day on CNN, on the news. People are crying, losing their jobs, their families, and everything. And I mean, at the same time, I can't say anything because Detroit's already hit up hard enough as is. So it's you're damned if you do, you're damned if you don't.
You mean that you think it's pretty strange that they're letting the contract so far from the site?
Right.
Yeah, sure, well, that does sound
true. There's got to be a spring company down there. Yeah.
Well, I think what happens, Blake, is, you know, governments always do this with all contracts, is they spread it out through every district. Like, for instance, all of the aerospace defense things. They probably got it for, like, if you're making some airplanes, probably got parts in, like, 40 states or something like that.
Right, sure.
I agree. I'm not disagreeing with you. You know, I'm just saying that's the way they dole it out, whereas it doesn't sound like the most efficient way to go at all. I agree.
It just seems like they'd make a nice exception for this one just because there's so many people struggling down there. I mean, you know, Detroit, it's happened to us over time, but this is something that
Bam.
Like, in 3 weeks, you got nothing.
Yeah.
You know, you were living the life, and now you're sucking up oil.
All right, Blake, thank you very much. I appreciate that information. Well, all right, we're going to switch a little bit. You know, here, this is some bad news, and it can be, like, really terrible. And that is what direction we're going in. Stay on the line if you're on hold and get your opinion on this, or if you're not on the line, you want to call 313-298-WRIF. Go ahead. Last week, I read a column by Alexander Coburn, which was called The Worst of Times and the Worst of Times. That comes from, what is it? Why can't
Counterpunch?
Well, he does, yeah. I meant that line about it was the best of times and the worst of times. Is that how it goes?
I think it was, yeah.
Tale of Two Cities.
Yeah.
By Dickens, yeah. But this is called The Fall of Obama. Kevin from Detroit just mentioned Obama. And you know, when you look at the alternatives, because with the collapsing poll numbers, the approval ratings of President Obama, there's just this giddiness among the Republicans. Yes, we're going to get back in. We're going to take the Senate.
Salivating.
We're going to take the House. We're going to have the House.
Ruin.
And we're going to have the Senate. Yeah. Although I'm getting email. If Carol's listening, a credible peace and social justice activist and also very active in the Obama campaign, she said she's had it with Obama and the Democrats. But and this is what the Republicans love to hear. And let me just read this. It's called The Fall of Obama by Alexander Coburn. You can see it at counterpunch.org. If all you ever read was Counterpunch, you would do okay. Although I read lots of other stuff. Don't agree with everything in it, but anyway. The man who seized the White House by fomenting a mood of irrational expectation is now facing the bitter price exacted by reality. In other words, we all expected something incredibly different, a change, a real change. The hopey-changey thing that that moron Sarah Palin always mocks, there was this palpable sense that, that after these horrid last 8 years of George Bush, with all of his lies, with all of his tax cuts for the rich, with the giveaways to the polluters, everything wrong you can imagine. Here was something brand new. This was going to be a new day, and this is what Alexander Coburn's talking about, that he created almost what Coburn says, this irrational expectation, and he's been slammed on the shoals of reality. The reality, he says, is that there can be no, quote, good American president. It's an impossible hand to play. Obama is close to being finished. What do you think about this? 313-298-WRIF. The nation's first black president promised change at the precise moment when no single man, even if endowed with the communicative powers of Franklin Roosevelt, the politic mastery of Lyndon Johnson, the brazen agility of Bill Clinton, could turn the tide that has been carrying America to disaster for 30 years. Is this an overstatement, or is he... Right on. And this is the kind of thing. Listen, I'm going to put forth a little good news at the end, because I could imagine some of you saying, you're right. I don't want to hear about it. I can't do anything about it. You know what? You can't do a thing about it. I can't do a thing about it. Jolene can't do a thing about it. All of us can do something about it, and all of us have done things in the past about this. This summer, writes Alexander Coburn, many Americans are frightened. Over 100,000 of them file for bankruptcy every month. 3 million homeowners face foreclosure this year. Add them to the 2.8 million who were foreclosed in 2009, Obama's first year in office. Nearly 7 million have been without jobs in the last year for 6 months or longer. By the time you total up the people who have given up looking for work and the people on part-time, the total is heading towards 20 million people. Now, this is interesting. I was talking with two neighbors of mine, and we were talking about two foreclosures that are, look like they're going to occur in our block. And we were saying how strange it seemed that in our particular lives, nothing had changed. Well, you don't know what's around the corner.
True.
I mean, you know, you're walking down the street whistling, well, not Dixie, but whistling.
No.
And wham, you pass that corner and there comes that 10-ton truck. And it could happen to me and it could happen to any one of my neighbors. But so this isn't happening to everyone. You know, even in the worst depression that we experienced during the 1930s, the majority of people were working. That's not it. But you have a collapsed economy when you start getting into figures like this. And who knows how far this could all go? Alexander Coburn says, fearful people are irrational. And this is why you get the Sarah Palin phenomena. Obama is the target of insane charges. A hefty percentage of Americans believe that he is a socialist. A charge as ludicrous as accusing the Archbishop of Canterbury of being a closet druid. Although Alexander Coburn has been in the United States for probably 40 years or so. He was born in Ireland. That's why he's talking about druids. Obama revers the capitalist system. He admires the apex predators of Wall Street who showered his campaign treasury with millions of dollars. The frightful catastrophe in the Gulf of Mexico stemmed directly from the green light he and his Secretary of the Interior, Ken Salazar, gave to BP. And, you know, it's not like if... I love it when I forget these people. Sarah Palin and...
John McCain,
thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, how soon we forget, how nice it is. I wish we could forget Sarah as well. You know, what do you think? They would have said, oh, no, BP, we're going to regulate you, and we're going to make you adhere to all the safety standards in your corporate criminal partners in Transocean who own the drilling rig weren't going to be allowed to set up shop. Sure. It's not Obama's fault, he says, that for 30 years, America's policy under Reagan, both Bushes and Bill Clinton, has been to export jobs permanently to the third world. Now, hear what he said? He said America's policy. Didn't say under their presidency. During their presidency, it said that was America's policy. The jobs that Americans now desperately seek are no longer here in the homeland and never will be. This is enough to make you turn off. This is not good radio, folks. This is only good possible truth. You know, this is one man's opinion. Makes sense to me. And it's also possible this can be turned around. But this isn't about good radio. This isn't about me trying to, you know, get great ratings and all that. I hope a lot of you are listening, and I know you are, and so does Jolene. But I'd be more interested in having a smaller group of people that are willing to face reality and take steps against that reality or create new visions of what's possible than just, you know, talk about some happy face stuff and right. continue talking about Sarah Palin's daughter. The jobs are in China, Taiwan, Vietnam, India, and Indonesia. Now, our pal Bob King, who has been elected president of the UAW, he's putting forth this in campaign. It's a whole new campaign for jobs, justice, and peace. This is a major institution yeah. in non-governmental institution in the United States, and they're talking about rebuild America by enacting industrial and trade policies that will create jobs, encourage manufacturing in America, and put workers first. I got to tell you, and I would tell this right to Bob, that it's 50-50 whether this is ever going to happen again, whether we are going to be reindustrialized. As it is now, jobbers are starting to leave China. Why are they starting to leave China and going to Vietnam and Bangladesh? Because the Chinese workers are organizing. And it's more of the capitalist blackmail. Do you want to work for the most insanely low wages for the biggest corporations in the world? Or do you want to lose, I forgot what I was either oring, or lose your job? So yeah, you got to get, that's the, yeah. Do you want to keep working for, you know, the worst wages imaginable? Or do you want to lose your job? Well, because we'll move somewhere else. If you want more than a dollar and a quarter an hour, we're moving to Bangladesh. So what's your answer, pal? You know, you're not organized. You're not fighting back. You're just rolling over and taking whatever is dished out to you.
Really, it's not a choice. I mean, they have to support their families.
Yeah, exactly. And by the way, I'm not right now. There's nothing you can do. When I say you, usually, you know, you think I'm talking generally, but I'm talking to you as an individual. There's not a lot you can do right now. This could be the beginning. This campaign for jobs, justice, and peace launched by the UAW and other social organizations. And this could be the beginning. It's also going to culminate in a big march in Detroit on August 28th. It's to commemorate the 1963 August 28th march. It was led in downtown Detroit by Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. This is amazing. Bob King yeah. has the same name. Our friend Michelle Martin is now the public relations director of the UAW.
Yeah.
And the first president, I told her that the first president of the UAW was Homer Martin.
Bizarre.
So could this all be happening again? The unions reshaped America, not just for their members, but for everybody. And the people who didn't want to give working people anything, didn't want to give us an eight-hour day, didn't want to give us a weekend off, didn't want to give us Social Security, didn't want to give us a minimum wage, didn't want to give us any health and labor standards or safety standards or anything. Remember, the Republicans, the conservatives fought tooth and nail against every one of these things. They were forced to. Because of the power of these unions and what they wielded for reforms at that time. Well, here is that same union that began it all, in good part, in the late 1930s, saying, we're taking up that mantle again. We're going to begin to do this again. And the question is, are you going to just watch it? Well, you won't even watch it on television because it'll be on. Remember, I always say they'll show a demonstration downtown Detroit and they'll be, we want peace and we want jobs.
They show people with their faces covered.
Yeah, and there's a storm, you know. We tell you, here's Jerry Hodak. Well, there could be severe weather coming in. And Sarah Palin's daughter is in the news again. And that was it. That's all you saw. And when history is written and your children or grandchildren or whatever, say to you, gee, back in 2010, when that movement, similar to the civil rights movement, similar to the union movement, the civil rights movement, to the abolitionist movement in the 1830s yeah. and 40s, what did you do, Dad? What did you do, Mom? Say, I don't know. I remember kind of seeing it on television.
Yeah.
All right. I mean, here's what I'm doing, which I say I usually don't do. I'm grabbing you by the lapels and saying, you got to do this. I mean, yeah, you know what? You kind of got to. I mean, if you want to defend yourself, you want to defend your family, you want to defend your community, because this is where, I wonder if this language is in here. I can't, there's a phrase that I was looking for. But here, let's go on a little more. Coburn says in this article in counterpunch.org, no stimulus program giving money to cement contractors to fix potholes along the federal interstate highway system is going to bring jobs back. Highly trained tool and die workers, the aristocrats of the manufacturing sector, are flipping hamburgers at best for $7.50 an hour. Because
if they can even get that.
Yeah, because U.S. corporations sent their jobs to Guangzhou with the approval of politicians flush with the money of the free trade lobby. Mm. When you hear free trade, when you hear free market, you know that there's people getting ready to rob you. Free market, three words, free market, free trade, austerity. These are people that are coming after your family's money. They're coming after our community's money. They're coming after our state's money. They want us to pay, well...
And we're not just paranoid here.
No, no. They are after us. You're not paranoid if they're after you. They want us to pay first for the huge mistakes that they made, for the you know, their absolute incapacity to administer their own system. It's their system. We work in it. We work for them. They blew it completely, and they want us to pay for it. But beyond that, they had long-term strategy, as he's talking about here, for over 30 years, to essentially destroy the middle class, to that their sense that it was more important for them to make any kind of short-run and or long-run profits than to sustain the country and the neighborhoods and the communities and the cities and the states in which we all live. They couldn't care less. And I love it when some of, well, I mean, I say that very facetiously, when some of you defend them. Are there any more conservatives that defend the corporations? Is there a one of you that would defend these banksters, these corporate criminals that have destroyed this country, that are destroying the environment? All right, where, let me see what else is here. Oh, yeah, this is, I believe this is in here, the phrase I was looking for. It's not Obama's fault that across 30 years more and more, money has floated up to the apex of the social pyramid till America is heading back to where it was in the 1880s, a nation of tramps and millionaires.
Wow.
Now, we always talk, you know, some of these libertarian money nutballs are talking about, yeah, back before the Federal Reserve when this was a happy, free nation. Well, that's the way it was in the 1880s. It was tramps and millionaires. And you're saying, well, wait a minute, Pete, you're really getting into the area of exaggeration. The people facing hard times, there's lots of people out of work, there are what, foreclosures,
yeah.
There's people giving wage cuts and benefit cuts and all that. But we're not exactly tramps. And hey, Pete, Jalene, you're not tramps. The majority of people I know aren't.
Not yet.
Yeah, there you go. Jalene hit the key phrase, not yet. But, you know, when you look at countries that suffer great wage inequalities like we are, they look like Mexico, they look like Guatemala, and they have this Colombia. I have a friend of mine who's married to a Colombian woman,
yeah.
And they just went back. She lives in Medellin. And I said, man, I'd be frightened to fly to the country. And she said, oh, in our neighborhood, everything's fine. It's like sometimes people say, man, you live in Detroit? Do you dare walk outside?
Yeah, I know, because people do think that.
Yeah, well, if you live in Sterling Heights or Southgate or even in a lot of some neighborhoods in Detroit, you know.
Absolutely.
But what happens in those countries? You have a third of the people. That's my Guatemala model. You've heard this before. The majority, how would you put it? The big capital, the exchange, the circulation of commodities circulate in a smaller and smaller circle.
Yeah.
So like a third of the population is doing okay. The bottom two-thirds are scrambling. And you're thinking, well, I got my job. You know, I live in Farmington Hills. You know, I live in here. I mean, how would you like it if someone said, well, you have an operation and you have a one-third chance of survival?
Yeah, that's a good way to put it.
He laughs. I don't know why I do. Yeah. So that's what, and let's say that there is to some extent, hyperbole here, an exaggeration. And however you look at it, this is all canary in the coal mine. It's a wake-up call. And if you want to remember last week, I was talking about how empty hope was. If you want to hope that Barack Obama can fix it, or if you're, and I hate to be insulting to some of you if you're stupid enough to think the Republicans can can fix this and won't really ruin it even worse.
A whole gaggle of other issues.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, let's see. Where else are we in this? It's not Obama's fault that he didn't. Oh, yeah. It's not his fault that every tax break, every regulation, every judicial decision tilts towards business and the rich. That was the neoliberal. That's a whole different phrase. It doesn't mean like liberals. America conjured into vitality back in the mid-1970s. But it is Obama's fault, he says, that he did not understand this, that always, from the get-go, he flattered Americans with their greatness without adequate warning of the political and corporate corruption destroying America and the resistance he would face if he really fought against the prevailing arrangements that were destroying America. Now, you know, there's a real reason to read. And sometimes what you can read and the power that it has doesn't always translate when it's said. Those are kind of long and complex sentences. But he says that without, the resistance he would face if Obama really fought against the prevailing arrangements that were destroying America. In other words, if he tried it without massive support from the population. He would, who knows what would happen. He offered them a free and easy pass to a better future. Now they see that the promise was empty. So now Americans in increasing numbers have lost confidence in him. And as I said, the Republicans are giddy with excitement for this. For the first time in the polls, negative assessments outnumber the positive. He no longer commands trust. His support is drifting down to 40%. The straddle that allows him to flatter corporate chieftains at the same time as blue-collar workers now seems like the most vapid opportunism. The casual campaign pledge to wipe out al-Qaeda in Afghanistan is now being cashed out in a disastrous campaign viewed with dismay by a majority of Americans. That incredible left-wing publication, Newsweek, this this issue is called for U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan.
Wow!
And written by a former Bush administration, his name's straight out of my mind right now, but you can look up Newsweek and see it. And that's how far, and he's now the president of the Council on Foreign Relations. Yeah. The polls portend disaster. Now looks as though the Republicans may well recapture not only the House, but conceivably the Senate as well. The public mood is so contrarian that even though polls show that voters think the Democrats may well have better solutions on the economy than Republicans, they will vote against incumbent Democrats in the midterm elections next fall.
I hope not.
Well, I think what's going to happen, but was I just thinking about that, or did I mention, this Carol, this peace and social justice activist who said she's had it with, and very possible she'll stay home. Sander Levin, the younger brother of Carl Levin, mm-hmm. who's our representative, I'm not voting for this guy. Forget it. And if it means a Republican gets in, hey, so be it. This guy is, just voted for another $33 billion for what is now Obama's war in Afghanistan. So I'll vote for the Green Party. Mm-hmm. Something like that, which throwing away your vote. What do you think, folks? So this is the trajectory of the way things are going. The powerful institutions and economic forces are at work against us. And if we face this as an individual, we better just revert to hope. You better hope that you're in the upper third and not in the bottom two-thirds. If you started in the bottom third or the bottom half, take it from me. You're definitely screwed. But we can move against this. Resistance is possible.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Julene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Let your opinion be heard. Call us at 313-298-WRIF.
Whatever's going on, it seems to be far from over.
Peter and Julene will be taking more of your calls right after this.
This is Matt Demmer from Jack Demmer Lincoln Mercury. I'm here to tell you that now it's more important than ever to buy an American-made vehicle. We at Jack Demmer Lincoln Mercury are still in the business of leasing and want to help you. Whether you're looking for the hot new Lincoln MKS, the sleek Lincoln MKZ, or the hottest crossover vehicle, the Lincoln MKX, Jack Demmer Lincoln Mercury in Dearborn is your one-stop shop. At our dealership, we believe in honesty, reliability, and support for our customers just like you. We encourage you to check out our virtual showroom on our website, Demmer.com. You can check out our vehicle inventory, and you can bet that if we don't have the vehicle you're in the market for, we'll do our very best to get it for you. While you're online, we invite you to get a no-obligation internet price quote. Whether you come into our newly renovated dealership or visit us online, we at Jack Demmer Lincoln Mercury invite you to experience the Demmer difference today. We're located on Michigan Avenue just east of Oakwood in Dearborn. Give us a call today, 313-274-8800. That's 313-274-8800. Or check us out on the web at Demmer.com.
Feels like time's running out. Maxed out on your credit cards, collection calls are coming every day, and you're two payments behind on your mortgage. You need help. We're Credit Card Relief, and we've been helping people just like you for nearly a decade. Call Credit Card Relief right now. The consultation is free, and the relief is real.
Call 866-290-8282. Not available in all states. Call 866-290-8282. That's 866-290-8282.
101WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit. This is Night Call on 101WRIF. Voice your opinion at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Now, here are Peter Werby and Jolene Jordan.
Well, we're getting no rest here. I know it's great for the listener, but it's not good for the bottom line, right, which is my throat.
Yes, that's right.
Raving is hard on the throat. Abby and Ken write in to calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Hi, Peter and Jolene. After reading the AFL-CIO news blog today, we're deeply depressed. Both of us were laid off around the age of 50. The audacity of the Federal Budget Deficit Commission to even consider raising the retirement age to 70. That's what they're talking about?
Yeah.
And cutting Social Security benefits is absurd. How can Pelosi and Hoyer, which is, you know, the House leaders, state that this issue is on the table? Here we go again, between George W. Bush trying his best to screw the working poor and middle class by privatizing Social Security, and now the Chamber of Commerce and those convicts representing us in the House and Senate who advocate rehauling FDR's genius Social Security Act. When will the insanity end? Please remind your listeners that the AFL-CIO and PDAmerica.org websites are great. I think that's Progressive Democrats of America. PDAmerica.org websites are great. These sites tell them exactly where to go to join the progressive cause of their choice. A lot of people are critical, as I have been in the past, of the union bureaucracies that haven't done right by their members. But in the past, it has been they that have led the struggles for the ordinary people, the middle class and the working class people and the poor, not just for their members. And now with Bob King as the president of the UAW, he talks explicitly, not just about doing something for his members, getting his members another dollar an hour more, but taking on the problems of this country. What did you say about somebody wrote into about not arguing?
Oh, yeah. I think it was Eric in Sarnia. And let's see. He said, I know it's up to people to call, but I miss when people would disagree with you on a more regular basis.
Well, I don't know.
He finds it more entertaining and informative.
Yeah, maybe it's not. All of a sudden, everybody is here.
Everyone's here.
They're ready
to party.
We're ready to party. 313-298-WRIF. It's Peter Werby, Jolene Jordan. This is Night Call. And here's Steve. Steve's from Westland, and you're on the air. Go ahead.
How are you doing tonight, Peter, Jolene?
Good.
Great, thank you.
I'm calling about this commercial I saw about a fellow running for governor trying to sell us right-to-work laws.
Oh, man. Who's that?
It starts with a B. I don't know. I cussed and walked out of the room.
Huh.
I think I saw that, too.
Yeah.
There was no party affiliation.
Well, you know, this is, they want to, these are, you know, they're trying to nail the final coffin in the unions of this state. The right to work essentially means that you have the right to pay workers much, much lower than states where you can have what they call union shops, right?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, no, it's terrible. I would be surprised that if, well, I don't know, nothing would surprise me about the Republicans there, but I'm sure, never mind.
Thank you, Peter.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you. Yeah. Be on the lookout for that. Right to work laws. I mean, this is how these scallywags have commanded the language. I had a whole bunch of them.
Because it sounds good.
Right to work, right to life.
Oh, yeah. That sounds,
What are some of their other ones? They got a whole bunch of ones that they work real hard to make it sound good, but actually it screws the average person. And, I mean, why would these companies be so keen, and these conservatives so keen to destroy unions? Well, you can see why. I mean, if Bob King and the UAW are starting to lead a campaign for jobs and the end of foreclosure and peace and social justice, they go, whoa, we can't make a lot of money off that. In fact, the more there is of what Bob King makes, the less money we make. It's all about not redistribution of income, but distribution of income. And right now you have this maldistribution of income that more and more money flows to the high side, and they're all about it. I mean, these people are insanely greedy because, I mean, they got all the money 30 years ago, 50 years ago, 100 years ago, but they just want more and more and more. They want it all. They want us. They want to, you know, they want to bring back the Middle Ages, the medieval times where we are their serfs, right?
Yeah.
Here's Keith in Sheboygan. Keith, hi. You're on the air. Welcome.
How you doing, you guys? Long-time listener. I just wanted to touch on what Reagan did to us when he did the free trade agreement.
Sure, tell us.
We were an industrial nation at the one time, and then they just, you know, we worked hard to put all those jobs together, and they just stripped us of everything.
But wait a minute, Keith. It was a guy named, let me see if I can remember his name, Bill Clinton that signed NAFTA.
Oh, did he?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. I thought it was Reagan that put that thing into work.
Well, that's Reaganomics at work. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, we were prosperous a little bit after that. But
oh, sure. We were prosperous until George W. Bush gave a tax hike. I'm sorry. All that wishful thinking. A tax break, this huge tax break to the ultra-wealthy, which in many ways set the stage for the problems in the financial sector. And also started two wars that had to be funded now to the, you know, the tune of $2 trillion. Hey, are you listening to us online, or are you you don't get us up there on the air, do you?
No, I'm listening to you online.
That's good. That's good.
Yeah, we hear you all the way up here.
Well, that's
beautiful.
Good. And, you know, Keith, you can also, if you want, listen to podcasts. You don't have to have an iPod to listen. You can listen on your computer as well. And, in fact, if you go to WRIF.com and go where, Julene, where do you?
Go to Night Call. Go to shows.
Yeah.
And go to Night Call.
Or you can go to Peter Werbe, WERBE.com. And as soon as this gets put up on by noon on Monday, mm-hmm. Thank you, Jade. It's
yes.
Also on our Facebook page. Thank you, Debbie, in Northampton.
Absolutely.
It gets sent to you. You don't got to keep saying, is it up yet? Is it up yet? It just gets sent to you. So, and it's free. We don't charge anything for it. All right. Thank you very much, Keith, for listening way up there. Appreciate it. 313-298-WRIF. Here's Lars in Madison Heights. Go ahead, Lars. You're on the air.
Well, hi, Peter and Julian.
Hi.
Lars, how you doing?
Yeah. Hi, good. I want to talk to you about globalization. I just mentioned that I actually spent most of May and June in Santa Fe, New Mexico, helping a friend run for Congress.
Wow, what a wonderful
really?
Town. We used to go out there.
Love it.
Jalene and I used to go out there to broadcast.
Oh. Well, you know, and Kokesh, the IVAW member.
Oh, yeah. Actually, I've heard him on some of the liberal talk shows. Yeah.
Yeah, the one who flew the banner at McCain's acceptance speech saying you can't win an occupation.
Oh, no, I didn't.
And oddly, he chose to run as a Republican.
What?
He got creamed in the primary. He got, like, I think, like 22%.
Oh, I forgot. Wait a minute. I'm so out of it. Did McCain win the primary?
No.
It's not happened yet.
That's right.
No, that's why.
I'm
not out of it.
No,
I'm right on it.
Yeah, well, basically during the presidential primary, and then he ran for House State for Congress, the House of Representatives for New Mexico's second or third district.
You're kind of losing me on all these numbers here.
Basically he ran as a Republican because he's really more of a libertarian.
Yeah.
He just got creamed by the GOP's candidate that they put in the run against him.
Well, he should have got Sarah Palin's endorsement. Everybody,
hey.
All the Mama Grizzlies, they win. Yeah.
Well, I just wanted to actually take up your challenge about defending corporations.
Go
oh,
ahead.
Really?
Okay, and please don't like cut me off mid-argument. Cause
I've been known to do that. Don't so don't be surprised if it happens. Okay. Make it short. Give me the headlines.
Okay, well, there's other factors that have corresponded to declining wages, because like the 40s, 50s, 60s, we were like the number one, you know, industrial power, because Germany and Japan were still recovering. You know, Korea, China hadn't fully industrialized, so we'd had no competition. I mean, you know, if you look at the products in that era, you know, they're crap. They're, you know, big, inefficient, and we could get away selling that to Europe and Asia because we're the only ones making it. You know, around the 70s, because I think that's the time when China started to liberalize its economic policies. You know, Korea started rebounding. So, you know, it's like even if we had put in, like, high tariffs on foreign goods, we'd still be making crap that we wouldn't be able to export overseas. So you'd just basically be forcing Americans to buy, you know, the crappy domestic stuff. I mean, like, it's that's
good. Well, in other words, we'd be having the domestic equivalent. We'd be driving the domestic equivalent of the Yugos, like those cars they made during the 80s. And all that. Well, I would really be rather, what were the X cars, or they had some initial or something like that. I mean,
the Le car?
Huh?
The Le car?
Le car?
Yeah.
Or whatever. I mean, it was the United States and the world joining the World Trade Organization and NAFTA that dropped these trade barriers, that there was a great part responsible for the great loss of jobs.
Yeah, but that's only part of it. I mean, plus also with the decline of the middle class, it's basically like in the, you know, that time period, there are fewer people with bachelor's degrees. So even though, like, and that's really the defining characteristic of the middle class, it's not wages, it's education.
Well, no matter how you slice it, look, Lars, things have gone down the tubes. And if you, it would be one thing just to ascribe it, to say it's sort of like the weather, you know, it's just the perfect economic storm. And, you know, there is an economic wheel of misfortune. And sometimes it's this area and sometimes it's that area. It used to be we were riding high 50, 60 years ago in Detroit, and the South was a wasteland. Now, you know, we're the industrial rust belt, wondering whether we're going to be able to pay teachers or keep EMS on the streets. And the South of the United States is in many ways a growth sector. But there's something wrong here. I mean, why are we so subject to the vagaries of an economic system? And in fact, I don't know why I should be giving it all over to Richard Wolff, who's going to be on the air at 1 a.m. in a recorded interview. He's talking essentially about an economic system that does not work and hasn't worked since its inception, that it works kind of well for some people part of the time. It works real well for some people part of the time. But there's always somewhere people in the world that are getting screwed real badly. Like all these people in Bangladesh, for instance, they had subsistence economy. They had traditions that were hundreds and sometimes thousands of years old. And now they're just wage slaves in these detestable, pollution-ridden cities making, my shorts something like that. All right, thank you very much. I appreciate it. So what Richard Wolff talks about is having smaller scale economies, more decentralized, and we might have to just do with less doodads. There's another guy I interviewed. I can't remember what his book was. Does it say here? Joe Badgett, Bagent. That's right. I interviewed him about his book, Deer Hunting with Jesus, Dispatches from America's Class War, which was a pretty cool book. But towards the end of this very long essay, he says, there's an unasked question which still hangs in the air. Does the money economy even exist anymore? Is it still there? Or are we all blindly going through the motions because we do not understand that for all practical historical purposes, it's over? We do not know how to do anything else. So we keep dancing with the corpse of the hyper-capitalist economy. See, the right calamity has not come down the pike to knock us loose from the spell of the dance. Or D, we're so friggin' brain dead, commodity and gore forged and internally colonized by capitalist industrialism that nobody cares, and therefore it no longer matters. Well, this is the kind of talk you get in down periods. When you're in an up period, I mean, everybody's saying, oh, this is going to go just, you know, on forever. The Dow is going to be 30,000 and all that. And when we're in a slump, people do predict total catastrophe.
Yeah, it's happening, too.
But the signs are here that it's not just the zeitgeist, not just the spirit of the times, but there are indications on every level, economic and political, and I mean the madness of politics, but certainly economic, that Joe Badgett was saying, in many ways there's nothing there. I mean, why is an economy contingent upon these institutions, these financial institutions that don't make anything? Provide
that's
any services.
Question.
They own this cyber wealth.
They own us.
And they own us. Yeah. You have George Golda, George Carlin, they own you.
Yeah.
They own you.
Right.
Never mind. I can't do his voice. And
that's pretty good.
Yeah. we are important. We are important. Everyone listening to this program is very, very important because, and I know not all of us work for any number of reasons, age, unemployment, illness,
disability,
whatever.
Yeah,
disability. But probably the majority of us work and then we get pay and then we buy other things and that employs other people. And there's a few of us that own things and they employ people. But I'd like to think everyone listening here is a decent employer and doing the best he can by his employees, you know. Given what's possible these days, but then there's, and that's just the you know, that's just the little frills around the edges, you know, the hundreds of millions of us that do this. The big stuff is all the stuff we can't understand. We don't understand. My wife said, "What's a hedge fund?" And I said, "Well, I have a hedge fund. So I went right. I went to Google. I Googled it, and I read it off to her. She said, "Well, what does that mean?" I went, "I don't know, man." And I, you know, I'm to the point. I think I said this about something else. If I can't understand it, an ordinary person with some ordinary intelligence, there's something wrong with it. It's put together by a bunch of thieves and con artists and racketeers and crooks, banksters, because economic reality, as it was for a million years before this insane system got invented, just did that. People did work. They didn't even have jobs. They worked. They did what was necessary for their lives. They raised their kids. They made music. They had all sorts of real cool rituals and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And they were affluent. They had everything that was possible. Then someone figured out we can get people to endlessly buy things. And in order to endlessly buy things, we have to endlessly create things. And then we can create endless jobs which depend on endless amounts of money, which then we can take that money and make money.
Yeah.
Is this a system?
Not a good one.
Yeah. And here, I was talking about earlier, this article, Bangladesh with low pay moves in on China. Right. One of the Bangladeshi companies in Ghazipur, a town you've all heard of course. The DBL group employs 9,000 people making T-shirts and other knitwear, probably the one I'm wearing. Business has been so good that the company is finishing a new 10-story building with open floors the size of soccer fields planted with row after row of sewing machines. How many hours a week do you think they work? This is it. I mean, Bangladesh is what I was saying earlier. Tramps and millionaires, right? It can't happen here.
And it could. And there was a quote from one of the workers, "Our family needed the money, so we came here," which is what we've been saying.
In Bangladesh.
All night.
Yeah. Metro Detroit set a new record in foreclosure activity in the first 6 months of this year. Almost 50,000 foreclosures in the city of Detroit from January to June.
Oh, my gosh.
Wow. All right. So, again, and remember I was saying you saying, I can't stand it anymore. There's bad news, and it could be me, and you're scaring the hell out of me, and there's nothing I can do about it. And I just emphasize again, there is nothing you can do about it all by yourself. We can do something about it all together. And like I, at one time, a few months ago, I said, I hadn't figured it out. I sure can't figure it out. I mean, but don't expect it from me.
Right.
I mean, but it, something happened. I mean, Martin Luther King Jr., where did he come from? Why wasn't there a Martin Luther King Jr. in 1952 or 1942 or 1932? I mean, black Americans were being screwed just as badly then. There's some convergence of social motion that is inexplicable.
Yes.
No matter how much of people are suffering, no matter what the nature of the grievance is, it takes a certain...
Yeah, and the answer is not Sarah Palin.
No. But could it be the UAW under the leadership of Bob King and the kind of the August 28th march he's proposing? You can go to the UAW. You know, they don't have enough going on it yet. You can go to the UAW site, uaw.org, and look over on the right. It'll give you the information about it. But if you go to my website, Peter Werbe, werbe.com, there's a link to the National March. And that's going to be October 2nd. I'm going to try to go to that. And now most people in this listening audience aren't going to go to that. But there was 125,000 people that marched down the streets of Detroit, down Woodward Avenue in 1963 on August 28th, led by Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., and in many ways set into motion what finally came about, the culmination of the civil rights movement and presaged the big march on Washington later that year. So
this, oh, very cool.
Yeah. So this could happen again. You can be part of history. You can make history. If not, you're going to be an object of history, and you just hope you don't get screwed. And the odds are you are going to be. Sorry to say. All right. So it's both grim news, but there's a glimmer there. We can do something. You can't do anything. We can. You say, well, yes, I can. I can, you know, I can work 9 jobs. Well, all right. A couple of you can. But, you know. No one
if
should have to work.
Yeah. Right. There's someone who works here and works 5 jobs.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
5. We work a half job. Never mind.
Yeah. Well, I know. But it's someone who's contracted to clean the building and works 5 jobs.
Oh, yeah, I know who he is.
5 jobs.
Yeah, wow. Here's Ron in Heartland. Ron, thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF. You're on the air.
Peter and Jolene, thank you for taking my call. I'm
thank
a long-time
you.
Listener.
Welcome.
We are all talking about what needs to happen and what the problems are. But the problems are with our own habits. If we stop buying the drugs that are coming into the country, there won't be a trade for it. If we stop buying the imported products, we just read the label and find out where it's coming from, start doing a little bit more recycling and making products, and not allowing the political magnets to come into play. And it's every single politician, whether it be Republican, Independent, or Democratic, they're all magnets to the big bucks.
No, they are. But Ron, let me ask you this. You're going to go buy a pair of shoes. Where are you going to get your Made in the USA shoes? You know what I'm saying? I mean, that's getting more and more difficult.
I don't need them. I really don't need a lot of pairs of shoes. We're just gorged with all this product and
consumerism.
All this.
Yeah,
I know.
It's pretty disgusting.
I'm sometimes embarrassed about. Am I a fashion plate, Jolene?
Well, you're not.
No.
You're not fashion forward.
No.
You know, you're not. We're not going to see you at the runway show.
But let me see. I have a pair of. I'm wearing a pair of Teva sandals now.
Yeah.
I also have some.
You're a t-shirt and jeans kind of guy.
But I mean, sometimes I tell my wife, stop buying me jeans. I mean.
I just think it's funny that your wife buys your jeans.
Oh, man. Yeah. Well, she said, they were only $25. I said, wow, man. But, yeah, so yeah, I am awash in footwear. And since there are no U.S., shoe manufacturers, you kind of got to buy it. I was somewhere. I walked by a truck last night, and it said, don't put sticker on. Man, I can't remember what it said on your foreign car. But, you know, what are you talking about? Honda and Toyota and Kia and all those. They're all made. They're going to be all, if they're not made, they're all going to be made.
Ohio,
Alabama, Georgia.
Right.
You know, they've globalized
Tennessee.
Us. Ron is the problem.
Yeah, that is the problem. It's the government, and it's pretty much all of them collecting dollars from the lobbyists who are strongly pulling, sucking the life out of the jobs that the unions used to hold and shipping them overseas. They should be taxed on on importing product in and make it so high that you just don't want to buy it. And then maybe we'll have a little balance in this the money that...
And the balance of trade. But here's the deal, Ron. Under the World Trade Organization rules, which the United States is part of, and under NAFTA rules, you can't do that any longer. You can't have trade barriers. So, right. I mean, you could put... you could put enough tariffs on cars that if you wanted to buy a Toyota, you could also buy a Cadillac, right, because of the tariffs. But those are all gone. So, I mean, there's this complete globalization. So where do we go? How do we, I'll tell you, I don't have any bright ideas on it. I mean, I do. That is, get a couple of things. Get rid of NAFTA. And the other thing we could do under NAFTA is have a continent-wide, North America, which includes Mexico, the United States, and Canada, have a North American minimum wage. And that would also mean probably very few immigrants would want to come here because they can make a lot of money down there. All right. Thank you for raising all that, and thank you for thinking about this. This is what we have to do. And I don't mean, in some ways I'm saying...
I mean, it's refreshing to hear him saying that he's sitting around talking with his friends about this.
And I don't mean, I was kind of saying, no, you're wrong, Ron. That was not saying that, but so much as... I didn't agree that that was a way to go. But the idea is that we all begin to launch these discussions. Here is Gary in St. Clair Shores. Gary, hi, you're on the air. Go ahead.
How you doing tonight?
Good. Thanks for calling.
Great conversation you got going on.
Thank you.
I called you about a year ago, told you about Denny Klein's water energy video. Did you ever see it?
I remember this.
Yeah.
I never saw it, but I do remember you talking about it.
Here's a guy that figured out a way to just take plain water, and he gets hydrogen from it, and then he ran his car on water.
Oh, yeah. Right, I remember that.
Uh-huh.
And he did a demonstration for Congress.
Uh-huh.
And he also converted a military Hummer to run on water.
So what's ever happened?
Well, apparently Big Oil must own the media because... I've called everybody, and no one will talk about it.
Huh.
That's weird.
Well, I'm glad you're getting a chance here.
Or you name it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, if you think...
And that was 2007, I think, he came out with that video.
And think about how disastrous oil is. I mean, the BP spill, of course, is a horrible wake-up, but it's been a disaster. I mean, we're giving billions and tens of billions of dollars of our money to countries in the Middle East because of oil. I mean, the price we pay at the pump is nowhere near like $2.79, where I was like, look, in Europe, they pay $6.75. We're probably paying that much as well when you start factoring in the fact that we're bolstering all of these governments in all around the world. We've got essentially we are involved in this campaign against terror because of the way these terrorists are reacting to our policies in the Middle East. If we didn't need the oil, you know what? We wouldn't even, neither side would know the other existed. But, Gary, before I go on, tell me tell people exactly what to look for on YouTube.
You just go on YouTube, you type in water energy, and then you just look at one of the windows, and it says Denny Klein.
Mm-hmm.
And, he was trying to make a safer cutting torch.
Okay. Well, let's just stick. I hope he does that. But let's just stick with the idea that this might be one possibility of getting off of oil. Thank you for bringing us that information. I'm glad WRIF is a place that's not ignoring you. Thanks a lot again. Anybody else heard anything about it? I mean, sometimes, it's too good to be true. Oh, here, I want to get this. I probably was wrong. Leslie from Commerce, do you have a U.S. American shoe manufacturer for us?
Yes. As a matter of fact, the SAS shoe comes out of Kentucky.
Really?
And they sell them at a foot store, a store off M-59.
Huh.
Called the Shoe Store. And they're not cheap, but they're great. They're fat. I work in the bartending. And they're fabulous for being on your feet all day. And if you want to spend a couple dollars, it's well worth it.
All Okay, well, I appreciate the information.
Good to know.
One of the things, though, of course, the biggest seller of types of shoes used to be the biggest seller were men's dress shoes and then women's dress shoes. Women, high-end. I mean, can you believe that? That women, you don't do this. You don't pay $500 for a pair of shoes, do you?
Ever? Absolutely not.
I know you don't, John.
Oh, do you?
Oh, no.
Yeah. But the most prevalent shoe, of course, is the so-called athletic shoe, which is now not used for athletics, probably used about 5% for athletics.
True.
And most people just, you know, wear them around.
Kicking around, yeah.
Those are all, of course, made in other countries. I used to buy shoes in Rockport, Maine, made by the Rockport Company.
The Rockport, yeah.
All China.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah.
Even that,
really?
Huh?
Yeah, they're gone. They're gone.
Oh, that's too bad.
They still have their little outlet, though, except they're not made down the road by
They're shipped over.
Boy. SAS, huh? Okay.
Yes.
Well, thank you.
I've been talking. They're fabulous.
Thank you, Leslie.
Absolutely. Have a great night.
You too.
There's hope. There's one.
Can you look that up? SAS.
Yeah.
Isn't that something
I've
else?
Heard of them. No, I've heard of those
shoes
before.
All right. Here's Kenneth in Southfield. Kenneth, hi. It's Peter and Jolene. You're on the air.
Hi, Peter. Hi, Jolene.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
You bet.
Long-time fan of the show. Peter, you know, you're talking about NAFTA.
Sure.
But, you know, the Republican Congress initiated NAFTA.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
That was a Republican. The majority of Democrats voted against it, but the conservative Democrats and all the Republicans voted for it. And Bill Clinton, who was never very liberal at all, contrary to popular myth, signed it.
Yeah. I think he was kind of under duress, too, because that Lewinsky scandal was going on during that time. But, Peter, I wanted to say...
Oh, Monica Lewinsky.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. She thought you said the whiskey
scandal. I'm like, well, I missed that.
It sounded like the whiskey scandal.
The
but
whiskey
I know what you said, Kenneth.
Can I make another comment, Peter?
Please.
I was thinking that, you know, with the right-wing media... I got a lot of free time, so I watch a lot of television, and all I hear is Obama getting, knocked and the Democrats getting knocked. And I think it's about the right-wing media. All of these TV stations are owned by corporations. And,
hello.
You know, and we, even if, that's why I think we might lose Congress is because of the media. So against, you know, Democrats now.
Well, they always have been. I mean, that's nothing new.
Seems with the addition of the baggers, it's a lot worse.
Yeah. I mean, if you listen to, like, Keith Olbermann and Rachel Maddow and Big Ed Schultz, you get a little different. I mean, I was reading some criticisms of Obama, and he certainly is a disappointment to me, although the alternative of McCain and Palin. I mean, I just shuddered to think what in the world...
Where we'd be today with them.
Yeah. All right, Kenneth, thank you so much for joining us at 313-298-WRIF. Tim and Paul and Brian, you hang on. We'll be right to you. Did you see this? The president of the University of Texas will ask the school's regent to remove the name of a former professor and Ku Klux Klan member from a campus dormitory.
You think that's a good idea? Let's do that. Let's get that down.
Simpkins Hall was named after William Simpkins, who was a popular law professor in the early part of the 20th century, but one with a dubious past. He served as a Confederate fighter and an early organizer of the Ku Klux Klan in Florida, promoting the Klan and bragging about efforts to terrorize and harass black people during campus speeches and publications.
But he used a much worse name.
He did. I didn't want to say it on the air.
But not even the one everyone's thinking about.
No, I know. On Thursday, Texas President William Powers Jr. will ask university regents to take his name off the dorm, that of the Simpkins name, a move that comes after weeks of deliberation by an advisory panel and two public hearings.
Yeah, it took you weeks?
Yeah. Well, should we take this Ku Klux Klaner racist, what about Robert Byrd? He was in the Klan. Well, I don't know. If someone said
At least he apologized.
Yeah. And if someone said to me, we're not going to put Robert Byrd, the late senator from Kentucky or West Virginia, who just died, I'd say, okay.
Yeah, I'd be fine with that.
Yeah, I'm okay.
On anything.
And I wonder who are going to be, so the regents are expected to bring the issue to a vote. And I wonder who it was that was opposing it.
I'd like to know.
Yeah, let me see. Well, I guess that's all for that. But also, and I think I read this yesterday, that the state of legislature of California, did I say yesterday, last Sunday, passed a bill to permanently declare February 6th Ronald Reagan Day in California. And they ought to take this guy's name off of everything. I mean, one of the, who will, I think, come to be seen as one of the worst presidents, corrupt, and...
the great communicator? How dare
even
you?
Even worse than that, even worse than that, that he set the final stage for the collapse of the American economy with Reaganomics. So this is just incredible. All right, we're going to take a break. Remember, at 1 a.m. Eastern Time, a couple of interesting interviews. If I had a memory, I could remember the ones that I did. Where are they? Where are they? Get out of here. The one is... Tom Dispatch. Yeah, that's right. Tom Engelhardt is founder of the news and opinion site, TomDispatch.com. And he asks the question, as does Newsweek magazine, why is the United States fighting in Afghanistan? And also Richard Wolff, he's the author of the book, Capitalism Hits the Fan, The Global Economic Meltdown. And this is important again, what to do about it. He says capitalism has failed. And you go to my website, see all this information. Peter Werbe, WERBE.com.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werbe and Julene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Peter and Julene are taking your calls at 313-298-WRIF.
That's what we do.
We'll be taking more of your calls right after this.
Time's running out. You're maxed out on your credit cards. The collection calls are coming every day, and now you're two payments behind on your mortgage. Every time you turn on the radio, there's some cheerful couple telling you how they got out of debt overnight. Their stress is gone, and everything's just wonderful. Come on. The truth is, what sounds too good to be true is too good to be true. You need real help, and you need it now. Not bankruptcy. That should be your last choice. We're Credit Card Relief, and we've been helping people just like you for nearly a decade. We're the attorney-driven program, dedicated to helping you get out of debt in months instead of years, saving you thousands, and without risking your family home. We know what we're doing. And we don't make promises we can't keep. The consultation is free, and the relief is real.
Get out of debt. Call Credit Card Relief at 866-290-8282. Not available in all states. That's Credit Card Relief, 866-290-8282. 866-290-8282.
Did you know the tap water in your home may be hazardous? Not to your health, but to your appliances and your wallet. Your home's hard water creates pipe clogging line scale, and that can shorten the life of your water heater, ruin your dishwasher, and break down your washing machine. Lime scale deposits block the heating element, and that could be costing you an extra $1,200 a year in energy and wear. But you can remove lime scale without chemicals, magnets, or salts. It's easy with HydraCare, the patented device used worldwide. See for yourself at bestsoftwater.com. You simply clip HydraCare to your main water pipe. HydraCare removes and prevents limescale buildup in your entire plumbing system. If your home has hard water, extend the life of your appliances with HydraCare. Try it risk-free. Just go to bestsoftwater.com. That's bestsoftwater.com. Or call now, 888-883-8187. That's 888-883-8187.
We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF. Voice your opinion at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Here are Peter and Julie.
Welcome back to our third and final segment, Crocus singing Eat the Rich. They're eating us.
It's actually our fourth and final segment.
What did I say?
Third.
Third? I have no idea why I said that.
I don't either.
Well, hey, there is some justice.
This is good. I know exactly where you're going.
Goldman Sachs and Company has agreed to pay $550 million to settle civil fraud charges that the Wall Street giant misled buyers of mortgage-related investments. Almost over half a...
What's that?
Half a billion dollars.
Yeah.
The one of the stiffest fines ever on banks and, let me see, gave final approval to the stiffest restrictions on banks in Wall Street since the Great Depression. This was the law. The deal calls for Goldman Sachs to pay the SEC fines of $300 million. The rest of the money will go to compensate those who lost money on their investments. $200 million? I mean, these are the criminals that have sunk this economy, and they're getting a huge fine. Just think about it, folks. They're really suffering, aren't they?
Let's see here.
The penalty was the largest against the Wall Street firm in SEC history, but the settlement amounts to less than 5% of Goldman's 2009 net income of $12.2 billion after payment of dividends to preferred shareholders, or a little more than 2 weeks of net income.
Is that not staggering?
And how about this? Word that Goldman had settled began leaking out about a half an hour before stock markets closed and appealed to pleased investors. Goldman had been trading for about $140 a share. The stock rose to $145 and then up to $153 in after-hours trading, so they made it all back. How come they're not frog-marching them out of their offices in June? Let's see. AIG is going to pay $725 million in an Ohio case, and they settling a six-year-old claim of accounting fraud, stock manipulation, and bid rigging. How do these guys not all just get sent to jail and their companies and assets seized?
That's a good question.
I mean, is there anybody? There's nobody's going to defend them, right? The teabaggers are down on the banksters.
Right.
Yeah. So,
even they're down on them.
Yeah. So everybody's down on them, right? Except for Bush and Obama. You know, they bailed them out. And so part of the thing is that that the AIG executives, they're figuring there's going to be a bit of a stink if the lawsuit is paid off with any portion of the $22 billion in federal rescue money that's available to them. So
now, but there was one good story about the Microsoft co-founder. I thought that was kind of cool. He's going to give away half of his fortune.
He's a cheapskate.
He's $13.5 billion. He's going to give away half of it.
Yeah. So he's,
this is what we talk about.
Yeah. So he's going to give away.
So he should have given away. What you think is he should have given away
all but
$12 billion. Just keep one.
No. you realize if he gave away $13 billion that he would still have $500 million?
Yeah.
You know?
Yes.
Yeah. So he could give away all, but in fact, it shouldn't be a matter of giveaway. It's not even, nah, you're a cheapskate. You're not really as generous as you come on. The question is, why do we have laws that allow somebody to amass that kind of fortune? But, as I quote every single week from Forbes, most of the richest people on the planet have seen their fortunes soar in the past year. That was for 2009.
Oh, yeah.
All right, let's go back to our phones. And here's Tim. Tim and Flint, thanks for holding on for so long. Hey, Tim. Tim? Tim, he held on for like 35 minutes from Flint.
That was weird. Well, that's right. Call back.
Yeah, he made a rude noise.
I don't know. Maybe he was embarrassed by it.
Yeah. Here's Paul in Plymouth. Paul, hi, you're on the air.
Hey, Peter.
Hi.
I just thought I'd change gears a little bit.
Sure.
Wanted to share with you and your audience a little information about the Michigan film biz here.
Sure.
I don't know if you guys have heard, there's a new television series that is solely being shot in Detroit. It's called Detroit 187, and it's been picked up by ABC. It's going to run next fall.
Great.
Tuesdays at like 8 o'clock. And,
wow.
It's
cool.
What's
the premise?
Name for the city of Detroit with Detroit 187. It's basically, if you look at the trailer, which anybody can see, can I just say where it's at?
Sure.
It's at the IMDb International Movie Database, imdb.com. You type in Detroit 187, and there's like a minute and 20-second trailer.
What's that refer to? What's 187 refer to?
It's the murder call for homicide.
Oh.
For police. And it's a pretty neat trailer. It's going to be, it's kind of like a CSI Miami mixed with, one of your, like, NYPD blues or something.
Wired and all that. Yeah.
Yeah, it's going to star the Sopranos superstar Michael Imperioli. He's going to be one of the detectives.
Yeah.
So It's going to be shot all the way in through December of this year for the first season, mm-hmm. and then they're going to do it all over again next year.
And they, and I think I mentioned this last week, Hung, the HBO, mm-hmm. special about the male prostitute. I mean, sure. It's always fun. Some of these, of course, I said to my wife, we were watching it, and she said, are you enjoying this? Yeah, I mean, she likes it a lot. And I said, I don't know, if it wasn't shot in Detroit and it wasn't all of this Detroit
landmarks,
scenery.
Yeah.
You know, and it's one thing. And what's your, Paul, what's your relationship to the film business, if I may ask?
I'm a location scout manager.
Okay. Well, you know that when the montage is put together, and I mentioned this last week, they could be totally improbable sequences, right? I mean, you see somebody on one freeway, and then they're getting off, you know, someplace where you couldn't possibly get off and all that. But so it's curious to do that. Have you seen Hung?
I've seen a couple episodes. It was pretty good. I mean, it's not my show to watch, but
well, I mean, the opening montage when he's walking down and throwing off his clothes, and he starts off in front of the Joe Louis Fist, and then somehow is able to walk to a little inland, you know, sort of suburban inland lake,
right.
and jump in naked.
You know? Well, hey, you know, there's another big one that's in town right now too. Wes Craven is here.
Oh,
he's
wow.
Filming his new movie Scream 4.
Wow.
And a couple other big ones, too.
Harold and Kumar.
That's here?
Yeah.
Transformers 3 is just moving into town.
What? Really?
Yeah.
And then also, what was the one they just made with the, I can't think of the guy, Richard Gere. Wasn't he just in town?
Oh, yeah. Something? Yeah.
As well as Pierce Brosnan just finished his film, Salvation Boulevard here.
Oh, that's
and,
right.
That's there's a couple right. more. There's a new one that's going to be released shortly that just finished up late last year called Cedar Rapids, and it's a hilarious comedy. I've gotten to see a
wait a minute, wait a minute.
That's an Iowa
there's
town.
There's a girl from Iowa who wants to have a word about that. What's
I heard
do?
About that. It's about Iowa.
And but it was shot in Michigan?
Yeah, because yes. they took away the film incentives in Iowa, so
they
we
did.
Got it.
They were 50% there, and they took the film there, but there was some sort of fraud going on, I think, in somewhere in one of the offices. So they pulled the 50% tax credit, and, it, of course, we're the highest in the United States right now at 40%.
Right on.
Hey, Paul, give us an example of I've often wondered that. I mean, being in the entertainment business, I'm often, I kind of deconstruct the montages and realize that, this has all been put together by a crew, which isn't the best way to watch a film. The best way, of course, is just to immerse yourself in it and be swept along with it. But sometimes, like you find like apartments or big mansions and stuff like that?
Sure. You know, we go and we'll get a call. We'll get sent the screenplay.
Give me an example, if you will.
An example of a film?
No, well, or something you've done that maybe the be the most interesting or something
like a movie.
Yeah,
or,
yeah, anything.
Okay. Let's just say Cedar Rapids last year.
Okay.
They needed a bar, but they wanted it to be big enough to shoot in, to put lights in. You go and scout 15, 20 places. You take the pictures and video, and you bring them back to the director,
mm-hmm.
and you sit down with the director and his director of photography and the top echelon of his crew, and he looks at your pictures, and he decides which ones. He cuts it down from 20 to 5, and then you set up what's called a tech scout, and that top echelon of the crew, the people that surround him and make decisions, go and see each location, and they narrow it down to that one location.
Oh.
And then you go in there, you sign, of course, you sign an agreement with the bar, and they are compensated for using their property. Then the crews come in with construction and set decorators and props, and they will build fake walls, put up, remove lights, put up, like in this bar, we put tin ceilings in, took down all the TVs. And then the set decorators come in and dress it up. And then, of course, the props people come in and they put all the props out to make the place look the way they would like it for the scene. And it's really a lot of fun.
Oh, yeah.
I want to be an extra. I want to be in a movie.
Oh, yeah, that's easy to do.
There's plenty of room for extras.
Yeah.
I would love to do that.
I got a friend that's sort of a professional extra. He owns a bar restaurant in Chicago, but he does this almost for fun. I mean, he's got an agent. He's been in, he was like in The Fugitive, and he was the, he was in The Matrix.
I have a friend who plays an extra here in the movies in Michigan, and he plays one character in every one, a homeless guy.
Huh. Hey, you know, and there's a friend of mine's father that was in Gran Torino.
Oh, really?
He was one of the church parishioners. Well, listen, Paul, it's very interesting talking
sure.
with you.
If you ever want to see all the movies that have been shot here, even for the past 25 years, you can go to the Michigan Film Office .org,
mm-hmm.
and they have an area that you can click on, and you can see all the movies that have been completed recently, as well as movies that have been shot over the past 25 years. And it's really, whether they were just here for a day or two or three or for, you know, a month or two, you'll see all sorts of titles that you didn't realize there was a little piece that was shot in Detroit or in Michigan.
Oh, great. Well, fascinating. Thank you so much for it.
And positive. Sure. Something positive.
Yeah, absolutely. If I lose this job, I'd like to do that.
Fun.
What is it? A site scout?
Location scout.
Location scout, yeah. Here is something I think you told me off air, but let's get it from Mohammed in Dearborn. Mohammed, hi. It's Peter and Jalene. You're on the air.
Hey, Pete. Jalene, what's going on?
Hey.
There? How you doing?
Good. I'm just driving around trying to put my daughter to sleep.
The soothing voice of Peter Werby will do it.
That'll do it. It puts lots of people to sleep.
And you know what? She's knocked out in the back seat right now, so thanks, guys.
There you go.
You bet.
There you go. So what's up?
I just wanted to tell you that, and we always discuss this because I'm with the UAW. I work for Ford, and I'm also involved in the union label. And if you wanted a pair of shoes, New Balance. They're made in America.
Really?
Some of them are.
Oh.
It's one quarter of them are. I just looked it up.
But you just got to look for the tag, you know, and if it's made in the U.S. But that's the only one that I really know of. I mean, that's any decent. But,
right.
And, you know what, hey, Peter, I never really heard you talk too much about the governor's race. I mean, you know, what do you think about Virgil Bonero?
He's the man. He's, I was mentioning earlier, along with Bob King, the president of the UAW that's calling for this campaign for the end of foreclosures and for peace and social justice. Virg Bonero's right there with him. I mean, what's his name? I can't, Dylan.
Andy Dillon,
yeah. He's a dead loser.
I think, honestly, this is my opinion, but honestly, I think that Andy Dillon is a Republican and Democrat's clothing. I really don't trust that guy that much.
Yeah.
But Virg Bonero is the truth.
Well, Virg Bonero can get some publicity. The guy is an incredible speaker.
Absolutely.
And, yeah, he could be the man. All right, Mohammed, thanks for calling in. A couple open lines in the minutes remaining. 313-298-WRIF. You want another good reason to stop smoking? Philip Morris is said to benefit from child labor. In Kazakhstan, a factory that, I should read it. I am getting really...
One woman, in this case, said children as young as 10 are working in these fields, Peter.
Really? Yeah. Well, you know, I'm starting to get my, what is that called, dyslexia. I read things back. Tonight I've been reading kind of sentences backwards. I always, in fact, I've trained myself.
You've been doing it so long that now you're reading things backwards,
yeah.
Okay.
I used to call fax numbers. Because I would look at numbers listed, and I would call the last one.
Oh, sure.
It was the fax number. I go, what the hell is this tone
beep
on here? Yeah. Human Rights Watch, the group best known for documenting governmental abuse and war crimes, planned to release a report on Wednesday showing that child and forced labor is widespread on farms that supply a cigarette factory owned by Philip Morris International in Kazakhstan in Central America.
They're probably smoking them, too. Did you see the picture of that 2-year-old or that 3-year-old smoker?
No.
Over in like Bangladesh or...
Oh my God. Yeah. None of these are sold in the United States. Only a tiny fraction of Philip Morris global tobacco purchases are made in that country. And they say that they are firmly opposed to child labor, but they always say stuff like that. Like Nike used to, you know, say, oh, you know, we're against
right
sweatshop labor.
Yeah, what else are they going to say?
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah,
really.
Right. But that's another reason to stop smoking. Here's Mitchell in Clinton Township. Hi, Mitchell. You're on the air.
Hey, Peter and Julian, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Hi, Mitchell.
I had a question, or I need your guys' opinion on something.
Sure.
I broke my ankle on April 30th. You know, I was out of work, and I figured with my time being off, I could maybe do something constructive, as in protesting BP.
Yeah.
So I got a bunch of my friends. We went in front of a gas station with signs saying, don't shop here. Then the owner came out and said, you know, this is really hurting me. And then I told my dad what I did, and he said it was kind of an ignorant thing to do. You know, it's a local business owner, you know. So I went about it a different way, and I started writing letters to representatives of BP.
Mm-hmm.
And
wait, what do you mean, representatives of BP?
Like people who work.
What's that?
Oh, people who work there,
like officials.
Yes. Not owners, you know, but representatives. I don't really know.
Like attorneys and things like that, maybe.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
And because one of them said publicly, people were yelling at them and about not being able to fish in the Gulf of Mexico, and he responded by saying, "Well, fish do not only live in the Gulf of Mexico."
Yeah, he said there's more shrimp somewhere else. That was like the CEO.
Oh, man.
Yeah, he said shrimp don't just, you know.
Right.
Yeah, you guys know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
And I wrote him a letter saying, well, BP is not the only place where I can get fuel, so I'll go somewhere else.
Sure.
And he literally, somebody else with him wrote me, actually responded to me saying, well, we really don't care where you get your gas because BP is not going to fall.
Oh,
and
wow. Such bastards. I can't believe that. I'd like to see a copy.
I don't know how, I mean, I'm still off, I'm on workman's comp, and I kind of wanted your guys' opinion. What do you guys think the best way for an individual, I'm 21 years old from Michigan, far as you can be from the Gulf, how can I go about it trying to make a difference?
Well,
you know what I did? I actually did my own personal protest of BP. Well, I had this, I had some, like, leftover food that was in my car that I forgot about in the back, and it just smelled like crazy. So I decided the best place to pull over and throw it away at was the BP gas station.
Yeah.
All right, Mitchell.
Don't do that, though.
I'm turning her mic off. Hers, not yours. Well, you know, it's what I said earlier. Very frequently, as a single individual, it's pretty hard to find effective avenues. I mean, here is this multinational corporation that scoffs at national laws, that does them, you know, its practices created this. And it could very well be that it's not even going to wind up costing them a lot of money. They can take all of this, you know, this is going to be off of their, the money they're spending is going to be taken off of their income and all of that. You know, for one thing, there's environmental groups, for instance, that,
The Sierra Club.
Go at least Greenpeace.
Okay, Greenpeace. Yeah.
You know, groups
they're
like that.
A little
that.
More rad.
And also, some of these things that I mentioned that take into account, I mentioned the UAW, that actually has, particularly under their new leadership, has great concerns for the environment. But this is beginning to percolate up. And there was just, if you go to my website, you ever visited my website?
No, I haven't, but I'm planning on adding you guys as friends on Facebook.
Oh, that's good. Yeah,
and Peter has a personal one that's peterwerbe.com, which is W-E-R-B-E. Check that out because, I mean, that's endless information.
Yeah, we like more friends. We keep talking about making it more active as well. But it's just facebook.com/nightcall.
Right.
So, yeah. All right, listen, I'm almost completely out of time. I got to get see if I can get two more calls in. Mitchell, stay involved. Stay engaged, okay?
All right, thanks, guys.
Yeah, good job. You tried, and I like what you did. Sorry,
yeah.
I do.
Yeah.
I think it's great.
Here's Paul in Sterling Heights. Go ahead, you're on the air. That was Mitchell, by the way, not Paul. But hi, this is Paul. Go ahead.
Hi, folks.
Hey.
Heads up. There is a book available for free online by a professor of psychology named Bob Altmaier. Might be a good idea for an interview, Peter, if you're interested.
Yeah.
The book is about authoritarians. And, in fact, if you just Google the words, the authoritarians, Bob Altmaier will come up, and you can download the book for free and read it.
I think I have that as a book on tape or a book on CD.
Have you listened?
listen to it.
No, not yet.
Well, you're going on a road trip.
I'm going on a road trip.
In fact, we haven't even said this.
Jalene is going to be flying solo next week. So
leaving me again.
Leaving her again. So maybe I'll take it with me.
Now, listen to these characteristics. The authoritarian followers have illogical thinking, a highly compartmentalized mind, double standards, hypocrisy, blindness to themselves, a profound ethnocentrism, and they're dogmatic.
Well, we know them. We do.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, they seem to be all around us, don't they?
That's a pretty good description there.
You know what, Paul? We're going to have to cut it short because we got to go home and got to start my segment at 1 a.m. where we got some very interesting interviews, including a guy talking about the economy that makes plenty sense. But I'll check that out. Thank you very much. Appreciate you being our last caller. All right, Jalene Jordan, I'll see you in a couple weeks.
Yes, Peter. Thank you, Jade. Jade, it's you and me alone next week.
Yeah. All right. But stay tuned for the interviews.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with more Night Call right after this.
Do you owe back taxes to the IRS that you can't afford to pay? Or are you stuck in a tax payment plan that's getting you nowhere? The IRS is now taking very aggressive actions, such as bank levies and wage garnishments. If you owe the IRS at least $15,000, call American Tax Relief. They've helped thousands of people like you eliminate up to 85% of their delinquent taxes. Call 1-800-493-8159. If you qualify, American Tax Relief can settle your tax debts for less than you owe, remove penalties and interest, and protect you from bank levies and garnishments. As a hardworking American, you do have rights. Call American Tax Relief for a free consultation and see how much money they can save you. Call 1-800-493-8159. If you qualify, you can save up to 85% on the taxes you owe. Call right now. 1-800-493-8159. That's 1-800-493-8159.
If you want a new computer but think you can't get credit, think again. Just call Tronics Country right now. No matter what your credit status is, now you can own a brand new desktop or laptop computer. Your approval is guaranteed as long as you have an active checking account and can afford small weekly payments. With Tronics Country, there's no credit check. You will not be turned down. Call right now and order your new computer. You'll also get a free color printer and a free digital camera. Just call 800-990-2258. But that's not all. Call right now and you'll also get a free 22-inch high-definition TV with your paid purchase. You heard right. A free TV with your new computer. All you need is an active checking account and your approval is guaranteed. Don't wait. Call Tronics Country right now. Call 800-990-2258. That's 800-990-2258. 800-990-2258.
Detroit's Rock Station 101. The Riff. The Riff. The Riff.
Play ball! Now pitching, Dave Black.
Dave is about to catch his opponent off guard. Not with his nasty fastball. No. Instead of a fastball, Dave will be hurling a tomato.
And the pitch.
Ooh. Using tomatoes as baseballs won't go over well with anyone. But if you're looking to hit the ball further and throw better, eating a healthy diet that includes fruits and vegetables is a home run. Packed with nutrients, they could help keep your body healthy and strong, giving you the energy you need to hit that grand slam. When you look at it this way, eating tomatoes is playing hardball against the competition. Run, throw, think, eat better. Can your food do that? Find out at smallstep.gov.
That's smallstep.gov.
A public service announcement brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
101 WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit.
Now, Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werby here with you. You know, it used to be whenever I would start talking about economics or have a guest that spoke about economics, I was always worried because people go, oh, man, that's not the most exciting subject. It's, you know, the dismal science and all that. Now, we do not know or learn about economics at our peril. Most of us are concerned, many of us worried, and well, we should be. There is trouble in our land. One of the things that people often speak about when talking about economics, they do it in very convivial terms, very kind of personal terms. Like if your family is in debt or you are making the people that are bringing in the money in the family, they're not making enough to cover the expenditures. Well, you got to cut back. Doesn't that make, quote, common sense? You got to have less expenditures. You don't go on vacation. You don't buy the more expensive whatevers. And what. So it's pretty easy. Well, because most of our minds, I think about a economic system, in this case capitalism, in pretty simple terms. We work, we get paid, we spend. Few of you own businesses. You hire people. If you're lucky, you make a profit. But we also know that there's this other stratospheric level of what they call exotic instruments and people selling money. Honey, you know, think about that. And people betting that that stock is going to go down and making money on that. That sounds a little, maybe the word exotic is correct. Well, let's get a look at all of this. And someone I think can really do a fine job with this is Richard Wolff. He's recently back from Europe, and he's the author of the book Capitalism Hits the Fan, The Global Economic Meltdown and What to Do About It. He recently wrote the piece Austerity, Why and for Whom. Now, remember, some of you have heard me broadcast when I say, when you hear the word austerity, grab for your pocketbook or your wallet, pals, because somebody is after it. And Richard Wolff is professor emeritus of economics at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst. He's currently a visiting professor in the graduate program for international affairs at the New School University in New York City. And by the way, he has a website called capitalismhitsthefan.com, and there's a video of his talk where a lot of what we're going to be talking about now is explained in greater detail. Let's bring him to the microphones. Richard Wolff, welcome to the Peter Werby Show.
Oh, thank you for having me.
We're reaching him in New York City. Well, it's hitting the fan, isn't it? We hear there's a recovery. Wall Street's hiring, the stock market's up about 10,000, little problem with foreclosures and unemployment, but hey, things are getting better, aren't they?
I hate to be the bearer of not such great news, but I'm afraid that the little recovery was restricted to very few parts of the American economy. Banks have done much better. Stock market has come back. But let's remember, it's only come back about half to two-thirds of what it lost. So we're not even back to where we were before the crisis. But whatever the good news for Wall Street and for banks and stuff like that, the reality is that when this crisis began, we had 7 million unemployed in the United States. Today we have an official count of 15.5 million, and that's been numbers been going up for the entire period. So there's no relief on the unemployment side. And since the Congress decided not to extend unemployment benefits, we're getting about 100,000 to 150,000 workers per week now running out of their benefits. And for them, not only is there no recovery, it's little short of a disaster. So I think that it's at best an extremely uneven period, an extremely uneven situation. And even the stock market recovery that went on for a while, it really lasted from about March of 2009 for stocks and banks until last month, or maybe May of this year. And now it seems to have petered out, and around the world there's a great deal of anxiety, even in Wall Street-type circles, that what we call a double dip recession, that is another downturn, maybe anywhere around the corner. So it's really not a happy prospect. As you mentioned, foreclosures are up. The housing market continues to deteriorate. There are at least as many signs pointing downward in terms of the future as there are pointing up.
Well, maybe, Richard Wolff, you could talk about the cyclical nature of capitalism itself. I mean, this has always occurred. There's always been prosperity, then there's bust. Usually then there's wars that allows great expenditures. But we already have a military-industrial complex, so there's not much place to go with that.
For us economists, if I excuse me for interrupting, but for us economists, it is a little bit of a mystery why people are as committed as they seem to be to the idea that somehow there's no alternative to this economic system. I mean, let's just do a very short review. We are now in the second of the most cataclysmic collapses of our economic system in its history. The last one was about 75 years ago, the Great Depression. Began in 1929. It lasted 10 years. President Roosevelt, who was the president over most of that time, did everything that Bush and Obama have done, plus a bunch of other things, and they didn't work. We weren't able to get out of the Great Depression for 10 years that it took out of the lives of the American people. And what finally did get us out was not an economic policy. It wasn't lowering interest rates or government stimulus. What finally got us out of the Great Depression after 10 years was a war. The United States basically took half the people who were unemployed and put them in uniform, and took the other half and put them in factories making the uniforms and the guns and the bullets and all the rest. And it's an amazing thing that we had that Great Depression, but even more amazing is that between the end of that depression, 1939, and the beginning of the current one, 2007, we had 12, count them, a dozen what are called economic downturns or recessions. So this is an economic system that is highly unstable and that on a regular basis plunges millions of people. Sometimes it's only 1 million. Sometimes, like today, it's tens of millions of people into unemployment, lost housing, lost wages, postponed educations, family problems, all the things that go with economic downturn. And yet it seems still to be in America a taboo about asking the most obvious question that a five-year-old would say. Something that doesn't work so well is something that we at least ought to have a national debate about, whether it isn't something that we ought to endure forever, and maybe we as a society can do better than this kind of an economic system that plunges us into this kind of misery on such a regular basis.
Well, Richard Wolff, the only alternatives that were regularly proposed as opposition to capitalism beginning in the 19th century were socialism and communism, and people generally see that as a non-starter, something that that worked horrifically. That it came about under the aegis of a police state, and so politically it's unacceptable, and most people feel that that economically that it was not viable as well. I don't know if that's where you were going with an alternative.
No, I couldn't agree with you more. I think that, like with anything else, if something you're stuck with doesn't work, and if something you hear about as an alternative, when you look at it, when you study it, doesn't look like a desirable alternative, you've got, of course, two choices. You can give up the effort to find an alternative and simply resign yourself to living in what you have, or you can be what I would think is a little more creative and say, okay, if the system we have is busted, is broken, doesn't work adequately, and if the major alternative of the last 100 years is not an attractive alternative, then ask the question, what are the other alternatives? And I think they're there. People have tried them around the world. In some places, they've had pretty nice record of success, and they've done things that are not like Russia or China and things like that. And, you know, we can learn from the mistakes and the dead ends of other people who also tried to go a different route without giving up on the prospect of a different route in the first place.
My guest is Richard Wolff. He's the author of Capitalism Hits the Fan, the Global Economic Meltdown and What to Do About It. It's published by Interlink Books. And his website is capitalismhitsthefan.com. There'll be a link on my site as well, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E.com, as well. All right. This is not a rhetorical question, but I'm here with bated breath, and I'm sure that many of our listeners are. What are our alternatives?
Well, let me give you one that has caught my attention and the attention of a growing number of people. And the way I would like to get into this is to talk about the failure to try to deal with the problems of capitalism. It was perfectly reasonable when capitalism began to show this instability, this periodic downturn, punctuated by major collapses like the Great Depression and the one today. Efforts were made to deal with it. So we have the most famous ones. The government comes in, pumping money into the economy, stimulating the economy, lowering the cost of borrowing money, regulating businesses. All those things were done in the 1930s. They didn't work very well then. They're not working very well now in terms of bringing our economy back. We are in the third year of this economic crisis and no end in sight. And I'd like to explain why I think they didn't work, because that'll lead me then to suggest an alternative.
Sure.
Basically, they didn't work because we leave all the crucial decision-making in the hands of private business. That's the way our economy works. And let me give you an example. In the depths of the Great Depression, it was felt around 1933 and 4 particularly, that the banks had gotten us into this mess in the 1930s, just like millions of Americans believe today, and quite rightly, that the banks played a key role in getting us into this mess. So a bill was passed to regulate banks. It was called the Glass-Steagall Act, a very famous bill passed by the Congress, signed by President Roosevelt, and it created a wall of separation between those banks that accept deposits, like your local neighborhood bank, and those banks that are engaged in speculative investments in businesses and foreign currencies and all the rest. They couldn't be in the same bank. You couldn't have a bank doing both things, because it was felt it was too dangerous that they would use or misuse depositors' money for speculative investment.
Well, they were some smart guys.
Absolutely, and they thought that that would work. What they didn't count on, and I don't think we should make this mistake again, is that the business community, particularly the banks, didn't like to be regulated that way. And they didn't want that. That hurt their profits. They wanted to make more money. They wanted to be able to speculate. They wanted to do what the law said they shouldn't do. And so they went to work from the time that bill was passed to basically get around it. For many years, they evaded it. They created complicated companies that were connected to one another, where one kind of business would be done by one part and another, and then there were lawsuits about that. And when they got bolder, they finally made a frontal assault on that bill in the 80s and 90s, and then in the 1990s, they finally succeeded, and they got the bill repealed. So there is no more Glass-Steagall Act, and it now became legal for banks to once again do what they had done before.
Those horrible Republicans, huh?
Well, it wasn't just the Republicans.
I know. Bill Clinton signed
it. Bill Clinton was the president who signed that bill,
right,
and who basically supported it.
Right.
And I think that I don't want to pick that particular bill. It's just an example. But most of the restrictions and the rules and regulations that have been passed forget the fact that so long as the companies that you're trying to control remain private, independent companies, they're going to do the obvious thing. It is the job of the boards of directors of these kinds of institutions, like banks, to make money for their investors. That's what they're there for. That's what they're hired for. And they'll be fired if they don't do it. They see these regulations as problems to be gotten around, as problems to be overcome. Now, that wouldn't be itself a problem, except that these bankers who want to overcome these problems are also sitting on the profits produced in their enterprises, which means they have the resources to go about to achieve their goals. They're the people who sit in the position in our society of making the decisions of what to produce, how to produce, where to produce, and what to do with the profits. So we really can't be surprised if they use their profits to get rid of the regulations, which for them are simply obstacles to making more money.
Sure.
If we don't change that situation, if we don't reorganize our enterprises, we really can't blame those businesses anymore. We should be blaming ourselves for permitting that kind of situation to exist.
Well, Richard Wolff, you're not talking about the abolition of capitalism. You're essentially talking about highly regulating it.
Well, I'm really not. What I'm trying to get at is to say, look, the regulation by the government, it doesn't work. It hasn't worked. It hasn't solved the problem. The business community is so structured that it needs and wants to either evade those regulations or weaken them, or, as in the case of Glass-Steagall, literally get rid of them. And there's no reason to expect, if all we do in this current crisis today is to redo some of these regulations, literally it's called re-regulation in Washington, then we're going to actually put into place the very regulatory structure that was undone over the last 30 years with this one difference. The business community learned very well in the aftermath of the Great Depression how to mobilize public opinion with think tanks, how to get a favorable Congress, how to invest money in campaign contributions, and so on. They're going to undo the current set of regulations more smoothly and more quickly than they did it last time because they've had all these years of practice. I don't think that will work. Give you another example.
Well, like the financial bill. That's
right. Yeah. The financial bill
ain't gonna do anything.
Really is a travesty.
Right.
It's not very strong. It doesn't have very many teeth. And it would have had to be stronger than the last time around if it was to have any chance, and instead it's weaker. But my view is, as long as we leave huge banks with billions and billions of dollars of profits to throw into the lobbying and so on, we've really seen, you know, the proof of what I've been telling you is if you look at the details of the lobbying for the last 4 months around that financial reform bill, I mean, you had the banks pouring in tens of millions of dollars to shape the reform. In Europe, I just came back, this is a kind of a laughingstock. The newspapers point out that the banks that were rescued by the United States government, using the money of the American people that the government gave them to make sure that the regulations now don't bite into what their freedom is to do as they want. It's literally that we, the American people, have been paying the bill for the banks lobbying to make sure we can't control the banks. It's you either have to cry or you have to laugh to get over that the absurdity of this sort of situation.
Well, it sounds, rather than an economic system, it sounds a lot more like a racket.
Yeah, it really is a well-oiled racket. Let me give you a second example that I think is even more perhaps
sure.
germane to your listeners' interests. There is all this talk around the world, and it's a reality, of something called austerity. And the argument about that goes roughly like this. The crisis hit in 2007. The country was at danger of an economic collapse, and that's true enough. And it was thought that the way to deal with this, at least in government circles here in the United States and in many other countries, was to prop up the credit system. And what that meant in practice was get the banks going again, because the banks were basically insolvent. They had lent money to people and institutions and corporations who couldn't pay it back. They had taken enormous risks, which they weren't supposed to, and the system had now broken down. So governments everywhere were called in to fix the failure of the private enterprise system led by the United States government. And by the way, it wasn't some wild-eyed radical, and it wasn't some trade union leader who had the idea that the government has to come in. The government was called in by the biggest industrialists and the biggest bankers in the world, who turned to the United States and other governments and said, save us, basically. And all these governments did it. The British, the French, the Germans, the Italians, the Americans, the Canadians, the Japanese, and so on. Now follow the logic. The government had to pour huge sums of money into those banks, buying their shares, lending them money, buying the bad investments that they had lent money into, and all the rest that we know so well. But the question people don't ask is, where'd the government get all the money that they had to give? The United States government spent $2-3 trillion with a T, right? And sure, the answer is, what every government around the world did, suddenly, starting in 2008, was to borrow the money needed to rescue the banks. And so all governments around the world borrowed wild sums of money, way more than they had borrowed in the previous decades. And not one government was doing this, they were all doing it. Okay, suddenly, therefore, around the world, there are governments borrowing huge sums of money. Well, who do governments borrow from? Not your average listener. I doubt any of your listeners have been approached by an agent of the government saying, gee, lend us some money.
That's right.
Who lends money? The governments are, here we go, banks, insurance companies, large corporations, sometimes other governments, and so on. It's the biggest, the most powerful institutions of our society. That's who governments borrow from. But here now comes the punchline. When those lenders, the creditors of all the governments, including the creditors of the American government, began to notice during 2009 and 2010 how indebted governments were becoming, they began to get nervous, like all creditors do, that they may have lent more money to certain borrowers than those borrowers are going to be able or willing to pay back. And that's what's happened over the world over the last 6 months. The creditors, banks, insurance companies, large corporations, and in some cases entire other governments, are looking around the world and saying, wait a minute, we're not so sure countries that we've been lending to can pay back. It's really no different from deciding that a person who took out a mortgage is no longer a safe bet to lend any more money to. And so what have we got? Well, what does a creditor do when that creditor is worried about a government? He goes to the government and he says the following.
Richard Wolf, yeah, let me interrupt you 1 second. We have about 2 minutes left. So, I mean, I want to one of the things I want you to get at is what can we do? What can the American people do? Go ahead.
I'll try to get at it real quick. So they go to the government and they say, you have to set aside money. You have to set aside money in a special account so we know it's there to be paying us interest and we pay back the principal. So you either have to raise taxes or you have to cut your spending on social programs to put this money aside, one way or the other. That's all austerity is. It's a policy imposed on governments to raise the money to satisfy the creditors. And what that means historically is it's the cost of this economic crisis being shifted in that way onto the mass of people, demanding that they pay more taxes and or cutting their social programs. So it's ultimately a political question whether the people of the world, including those here in the United States, are willing to carry the cost, higher taxes and or cut programs, to bail out an economic system that hasn't worked very well in the first place. What to do?
Mm-hmm.
I think the basic thing that has to be faced, scary as it may be to some folks, is to ask the question, is it a reasonable way to organize an economy so that the mass of people are always in the position of workers? They come at 9 in the morning, they go home at 5 in the end of the day. They do not make the decisions about what's produced, how it's produced, where it's produced, what's done with the profits. Those decisions are made by very small groups of people called boards of directors, 15 to 20 people, who get selected by the major shareholders. That's another group of 15 to 20 people. They make decisions based on what is profitable. They do not make decisions based on what is good or necessary for the mass of the people. And if that doesn't produce an outcome that we as a people like, we ought to ask whether it has to do with the way this situation is organized. Are there examples of people who have changed this system? The answer is yes, and there's some of them here in the United States. Over the last 30 years, every year, dozens, sometimes hundreds of software engineers in Silicon Valley in California quit their jobs with IBM and Intel and those big companies, and they form smaller companies on the following rule. Everybody comes to work. We're all equal here. Monday to Thursday, we all work together on software with our little computers. Friday, we come to work. We do not work on software. We have meetings all day, and we decide what to produce, how to produce, where to produce, and what to do with the profits of our enterprise. It is, if you like, a democratically organized enterprise. And for a country which prides itself admirably on its commitment to democracy, it has always been a mystery why democracy, if it's such a good idea outside the factory, outside the office, might not be a good idea inside the factory and inside the office. And I think if we look around, we'll see that the workers, for example, those engineers in California, when you ask them, they will explain, I quit the job in the other place where I had to come to work in a tie and a jacket and I had to do what a boss said who doesn't even understand what I'm doing. I much prefer the new work situation I have. I'm very glad I have this new kind of enterprise. I feel more productive. I feel happier about coming to work.
Let me do this. Unfortunately, we're completely out of time. Okay. It is terrible that I am interrupting Richard Wolf.
No, there is so much here.
Well, I feel it is. This is explained in full detail in Richard Wolff's website, capitalismhitsthefan.com. Richard Wolff is the author of Capitalism Hits the Fan, the Global Economic Meltdown and What to Do About It. And he was just beginning to scratch the surface of it, and the timing of it, my fault. More at the website also, and you give me a big yes or no, and then we got to go. There in Spain, there's this big workers' cooperative called Mondragon.
That's right.
M-O-N, perfect. Like M-O-N Dragon. Check it out. Richard Wolf, thanks so much for joining me on the Peter Werbe Show.
I'd be glad to do it anytime.
I am sorry.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with another guest right after this.
Join Al Slayer back this Thursday from noon to 2 p.m. at Advanced Auto Parts on Eureka Road in Southgate. It's the grand opening celebration. Stop by for unbeatable prices and great grand opening specials. Plus, check out the famous monster truck Gravedigger 21. Test your skills with Monster Jam Urban Assault and tour the Digger Dungeon.
Do people sometimes describe you as a saver, a bit frugal, penny-wise, and somewhat thrifty?
You know, cheap.
If that sounds like you, you're going to love the newest addition to MotorCitySteelsAndDeals.com.
Coupon crazy!
At MotorCitySteelsAndDeals.com, you'll still find great gift certificates for local businesses with goods and services on sale for more than half off. Find money-saving online coupons that you can download right now and start saving immediately. Log on to MotorCitySteelsAndDeals.com and save big.
With online coupons from Autolab USA, with over 20 locations in the Metro Detroit area and a 12,000-mile, 12-month warranty. Hagopian Rug Care Center with 5 locations in Metro Detroit. They're the leader in carpet, rug, furniture, and tile cleaning.
If you're looking for ways to enjoy life and stay within your budget, then go
coupon crazy
now at MotorCitySteelsAndDeals.com. That's MotorCitySteelsAndDeals.com. Your online home for great ways to save big at local Michigan businesses.
Time's running out. You're maxed out on your credit cards. The collection calls are coming every day, and now you're 2 payments behind on your mortgage. Every time you turn on the radio, there's some cheerful couple telling you how they got out of debt overnight. Their stress is gone, and everything's just wonderful. Come on. The truth is, what sounds too good to be true is too good to be true. You need real help, and you need it now. Not bankruptcy. That should be your last choice. We're Credit Card Relief, and we've been helping people just like you for nearly a decade. We're the attorney-driven program, dedicated to helping you get out of debt in months instead of years, saving you thousands, and without risking your family home. We know what we're doing, and we don't make promises we can't keep. The consultation is free, and the relief is real.
Get out of debt. Call Credit Card Relief at 866-290-8282. Not available in all states. That's Credit Card Relief. 866-290-8282. 866-290-8282.
Did you know the tap water in your home may be hazardous? Not to your health, but to your appliances and your wallet. Your home's hard water creates pipe-clogging line scale, and that can shorten the life of your water heater, ruin your dishwasher, and break down your washing machine. Line scale deposits block the heating element, and that could be costing you an extra $1,200 a year in energy and wear. But you can remove line scale without chemicals, magnets, or salts. It's easy with HydraCare, the patented device used worldwide. See for yourself at bestsoftwater.com. You simply clip HydraCare to your main water pipe. HydraCare removes and prevents lime scale buildup in your entire plumbing system. If your home has hard water, extend the life of your appliances with HydraCare. Try it risk-free. Just go to bestsoftwater.com. That's bestsoftwater.com. Or call now, 888-883-8187. That's 888-883-8187.
We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werby here with you. Here's a question. Why are we in Afghanistan? I almost said Vietnam. I was reading something about Vietnam just earlier today. But, yeah, a little bit of an analogy there. But why are we in Afghanistan? Most people would say, if they even think about it, you may be thinking about it since I've posed the question. Normally, it's just sort of a little background noise once in a while. 8 Americans killed, and so we're a bit aware. But we're fighting the Taliban. Why are we fighting the Taliban? Because the Taliban were connected with Al-Qaeda, weren't they? 9/11 and all that? I mean, it's getting to be pretty far back. But maybe we could bring this all up to date by talking with Tom Engelhardt. Tom Engelhardt is the founder of TomDispatch.com. TomDispatch.com. That's an online news and opinion site. I get a lot of my information from it. Got great people writing about the things that matter. Tom has a brand new book. It's called The American Way of War, How Bush's Wars Became Obama's. Just been released by Haymarket. He's also has a latest piece called Why Are We in Afghanistan? As Petraeus Takes Over, Could Success Be Worse Than Failure? Let's get an idea what that's all about. We reached Tom Engelhardt in New York City. Welcome to the broadcast.
Hi, Peter.
I'm almost debating where to start. Tell us about TomDispatch.com. How does one start an online news and opinion site and have it just explode the way yours has?
Well, I would say by accident, actually. In real life, or what once passed for real life, I was a book editor. You know, I did some great Midwestern figures like Studs Terkel and so on and so forth.
Really?
After 9/11, I became disturbed with kind of the increasing narrowness of the coverage of how the world was working, and I began a little e-list just for friends, you know, just sending around the odd piece that I found interesting with a little commentary of my own, and people started getting online. I'm old enough so that I really hardly understood the internet when I began, so I've stumbled into everything. The Nation Institute, which is connected to The Nation magazine, decided to put it up as the website TomDispatch.com, so I went from a no-name site to Tom Dispatch, and I started as a former book editor. I started asking many of the authors that I had worked with, Chalmers Johnson and various other people, to if they wanted to write for the site, and in the end, we've ended up with my commentary and the commentary of other people, news reporting on our wars in particular, and particularly on our garrisoning of the planet. And it's now, I don't know, I'm 8 or 9 years on, and, you know, unfortunately in some ways, because I'm kind of following the path of the Afghan war in a certain sense, and that's what I wrote about recently, a war that, as you were saying, we kind of once knew why we were there, sort of, or at least we were told, but 9 years later, I think it's open for question. It's just that nobody's asking.
We have to ask this. Let me ask just a little more about the website.
Sure.
So people will get, if they're not already, will get acquainted with TomDispatch.com. That's Dispatch, D-I-S-P-A-T-C-H. There'll be a link on my website as well, Peter Werby, W-E-R-B-E.com, in case you missed it at all. You know, I noticed some of the websites that I visit as well, like CommonDreams.org, and also a number of others, that they're often raising tens of thousands of dollars to maintain them. Does that same cost accrue to yours as well?
No. Partially, I'm supported by the Nation Institute. I'm a fellow there. And there's, you know, I've got a pretty simple website, and I'm a cheap date, you might say. I mean, I still work as a book editor, so I make part of my living off the site, thanks to the Nation Institute, and part off my book editing. And actually, amazingly enough, in recent years, readers who really are readers of Tom Dispatch, because the one thing I should say about Tom Dispatch is, unlike a lot of the web, I tend to let things go long. I tend to think the point of Tom Dispatch is to put the world in some kind of context and to connect a lot of the dots that normally aren't connected in the media. Everything's thrown at you, but very little is connected. So I tend to run not short but long, and I think the people at the site are real readers, and they've been contributing money, which has allowed me to get a little. You know, I'm almost 66 years old, and I've gotten a couple of young guys to help me as assistants, and I have a little extra money. I've got, for instance, a great young reporter out in Afghanistan who's also worked for the Wall Street Journal and other places, who I can pay a little extra to go out and look for stories and so on and so forth. But mostly, I am a really inexpensive site.
Good. Good. I mean, that's terrific. TomDispatch.com is the name of it. And Tom Engelhardt, the editor and founder of the news and opinion site, is our guest on the Peter Werbe Show. Now, in the history of opposition to government policy, going, even back into the late 18th century, and then the abolitionists and the union movements and the underground press in the 1960s, it was always print. That's people would start their own newspaper. Because they wanted to have their perspective on the world. Do you think it is? I mean, you don't sound 66, so so you're kind of like me, rooted back in the 20th century. Is online where it is? Is print gone?
I'm afraid it is. I mean, I'm an energetic almost 66, I would say, but you know, I'm still an inveterate reader of papers in print. I mean, I read the New York Times, my hometown paper, every day. I read the Wall Street Journal in print, and then I go online and read everywhere else, because the truth is, if you know anybody under 25, they are not reading a paper in print.
Sure.
You know, I taught at a journalism school. I used to teach there. This was some years back. And at one point I asked about 45 journalism students in a room who could pick up, most of the papers were free at the journalism school. How many of them read papers, you know, in print? And, you know, it was, even then it was 4, 5, 6, and these are journalism students. So I think the answer is, yes, that the world is heading toward the web, and it's just where I happen to end up.
Let's go into some of the content then of both your new book, The American Way of War, How Bush's Wars Became Obama's, and also the piece you just released, Why Are We in Afghanistan? As Petraeus Takes Over, Could Success Be Worse Than Failure? Let's go back in history. I mean, already, I mean, the American sense of history is usually about 2 weeks, and the origins of this war seem to be kind of, kind of foggy. I mean, we went in there after 9/11. Think about it. You said people under 25, so someone who was 21 now, they were like 12 when 9/11.
And imagine this, if you really want to go into history, they were many years from being born when we actually first went into Afghanistan, because we first went in 1979. I mean, in a warlike way, because we went in to fight the Soviets, and the CIA had a massive program of support for what became the fundamentalist jihadists who were now fighting. I mean, in the case of the anti-Soviet war, we are literally fighting two or three of the kind of warlord types who make up parts of what we call the Taliban, which is kind of this disparate group, were our guys in the 1980s. I mean, it's amazing to think this, that we funded them, we armed them, we trained them, we now are fighting them. So, I mean, Afghanistan is usually referred to as the graveyard of empire and of empires. And I mean, this was true for the Brits, the Russians, and now it seems to be significantly true for us. And I think left, right, and center at this point, everybody is talking about the latest, and this is just the latest 9 years later, of American strategies or tactics, which is counterinsurgencies, as a kind of failure. What I did recently at the Tom Dispatch website was I wrote a piece, you know, because criticism you know, failure attracts critics the way a dead body attracts flies. And I tried to, I thought to myself, let's do a little thought experiment. Let's assume that Petraeus actually comes in and does in Afghanistan what he's going to do, what he did in Iraq. That is, he comes back as a kind of success. And for an American general in the 21st century, a raging success is kind of to tie or do a little better, so-called blunt the Taliban. So he succeeds. And I thought to myself, what would success mean instead of failure? And success, of course, would mean that we might end up in minimal control of the fifth poorest country on earth, the second most corrupt country on earth, the world's premier narco state. We would own their army, which we would have to pay for. We would have trained it up. We would own their police, which we would have trained for, and we would have had to pay them up. There are, in essence, at this point, according to the CIA director, almost no Al-Qaeda members in Afghanistan. So we would have denied, maybe, if success happened, we would have denied for fabulous sums of money Afghanistan to Al-Qaeda. We might not have, but at the best, we would have. And that would be one out of many countries. But, of course, Al-Qaeda isn't in Afghanistan anymore. They're in the borderlands of Pakistan. They're in Somalia. They're in Yemen. So there is a kind of absurdity, this ongoing war. And that's what I was trying to get at, that actual success might mire us in Afghanistan longer than failure would at the cost, conservatively estimated at this point, of about $84 billion a year. It's probably actually more.
Yeah, and, let's go back again, if you would, to September 11th. So yeah. Here, the Taliban were declared the enemy after Bush had some sort of detente with them almost when he was governor, and then first months of his presidency in 2001. They were accused of essentially allowing Al-Qaeda to do what they did on September 11th. Do we even know that that's true?
I think we do think that. Think of it this way. Afghanistan was a place of convenience. It was the backlands and remains the backlands of the planet. It was a place of convenience for Al-Qaeda. But it wasn't the only place of convenience. I mean, and we know that 9/11 was planned in part from Hamburg, Germany, which we didn't bother to invade, and that some of it was carried out from Florida, where some of those guys were before they got on those planes. I mean, the problem is that Al-Qaeda, which at its height, before we were really going after them, was capable of doing spectacular acts every couple of years. That was it. They were a fairly ragtag, ambitious outfit, one of the things, and this is something I've written about both in my book, The American Way of War, and regularly at the website, one of the problems is that despite 9/11, terrorism has been blown all out of proportion in this country. If you actually look at the statistics, since 9/11, Americans have suffered from terrorism slightly above shark attacks and below just about everything else you'd want to mention, from domestic abuse to fire or smoking deaths to car accidents. You know, just car accidents in New York State are staggeringly greater than any possible set of terrorist attacks. I mean, it's a phenomenon. It's a real thing, but it's a phenomenon that's been blown out of proportion, has turned into a kind of industry in this country with the Homeland Security Department and the little mini Homeland Industrial Security complex around it, and it's led to this ongoing, unbelievably expensive war that I think that the Obama people took over, and that I do not think they have a particular explanation for, other than the old 9/11 explanation. I mean, the Bush people would have had some explanations for Afghanistan, but I think the Obama people are kind of managing a war with a momentum all its own, and I think this is something that we should really step back and think about. Why are we in Afghanistan? It was the classic question of Vietnam, and to some extent the question of Iraq, but nobody asked it about Afghanistan.
Tom Engelhardt is my guest on the Peter Werbe Show. His website, which is an online news and opinion site, is tomdispatch.com. His new book from Haymarket Books is The American Way of War, How Bush's Wars Became Obama's. Now, two things occur to me. The first is someone's listening to this and saying, whoa, what is he saying? That we should let our guard down against these people that intend to do great harm to us, and they're rolling, I mean, they seem inept, they're rolling cars that with bombs in them that don't go off in Times Square, the guy can't even light his underpants, you know, over Detroit and what have you, but it's not through any lack of trying. So, I mean, I understand what you're saying, because there has not been a significant number of terrorist deaths since 9/11 of Americans, where we've lost thousands and thousands of American soldiers who have created tens of thousands of deaths of people in Iraq and Afghanistan. But I think people are probably worried enough that they would be very sympathetic to the idea of what it may sound like you're saying, quote, let our guard down.
Let me put it this way. You're in Michigan. You know the unemployment rate in Michigan.
Right.
You know the state of the aging infrastructure of Michigan. We have now spent a cumulative at least $1 trillion on these distant wars, Iraq and Afghanistan. And, of course, Iraq had nothing really to do with 9/11 whatsoever. And that $1 trillion is probably an underestimate. It's not taking in monies that aren't directly in the Pentagon or in the warfighting budget, but our military. It's not taking in what we're going to have to pay for our wounded over the many years to come and so on and so forth. If we had simply locked our plane doors, guarded our borders, and come home and put that money into Michigan and various other states, into our infrastructure, into the disasters we have here, I believe we would have been much safer. I mean, Al-Qaeda is a real thing, and it has to be dealt with, but it was never reasonable to deal with Al-Qaeda, which is a stateless organization, by simply invading a country, and a country that, in essence, was hardly a state, that had no government. I mean, we talk about counterinsurgency right now, but counterinsurgency involves the government. So now we are trying a country, this is us, where at home we're agreed. We are not so sure we know how to govern ourselves well, but we are in Afghanistan right now trying to teach the Afghans how they should govern themselves well. This is a very, very strange situation. I actually think that rather than letting our guard down, that we have let our guard down. We have put unbelievable amounts of money into fruitless distant wars, and in that way, you know, I mean, if Osama bin Laden could have had a dream scenario of what we might do in response to his modest-sized organization, it probably would be exactly what's happened, you know, which I think weakened enormously this country, which I do care about.
Well, when people say, what are these wars about? Some people will say they've been wars for oil, they've been wars for pipelines, you know, Afghanistan has been called Pipelanistan and all that, for national security and what have you. What about the idea that it's essentially a war for war, is that we have a military-industrial complex? We have to, if it stalls, if we don't have an enemy, you know, we don't have the Soviet Union anymore, we're still having these enormous weapons systems, and without an enemy, that sector of the economy, which is becoming larger and larger, kind of falls on its face.
Well, Peter, this is a great theme of TomDispatch.com, although I would say that the one thing I would say about wars, like much else in our world, is they're distinctly overdetermined. That is, I don't think you can just say it's just oil or it's just the military-industrial complex or whatever, but yes, that is a major factor. I mean, war, for one thing, and this is one of the real themes of my book, The American Way of War, for one thing, we Americans have gotten used to war as a norm, war that's just ongoing and very distant, and Americans are very detached. Unlike in the Vietnam era and actually in earlier eras, including the Second World War, Americans are strangely detached from their wars. We're kind of as a nation like our sexiest weapons, which are those drones flying over the Pakistani borderlands, in which the pilots are sitting 8,000 miles away in Nevada. You know, we as a people, in a way, the war, because we no longer have a citizen army, has been left to a small group, a teeny percentage of American professionals called volunteers and their families and so on and so forth, and a significantly similar slice of for-profit warriors, which are the various corporate mercenaries who are hired to support the Pentagon. I mean, because the Pentagon's been surprised, and war itself has been surprisingly privatized, and all all of this has left war very far from our individual lives, so that we go on with all our problems. Our wars go on somewhere else. Casualties compared to Vietnam are relatively low and kept relative. I mean, they're significant, but they're still relatively low. And so there is a kind of just momentum to war, as you say, and there's a great profit in war as well. And I think the momentum is so great that while the Bush people were using wars to do various things, I mean, they were visionaries, even if they were, to my mind, mad visionaries and very wrong in what they were doing, very mistaken. The new administration is not that. They think rather differently, but they're still managing the same wars in remarkably the same way. And that's why in my subtitle I say how Bush's wars became Obama's, because somehow Obama, who was hired as a kind of anti-war candidate, elected as a kind of anti-war candidate, has in fact managed both the Iraq and Afghan wars and the global war on terror, you know, very much as the Bush people were doing it in the last couple of years of the Bush's second term.
Hmm. Tom Engelhard of TomDispatch.com is my guest on the Peter Werbe Show. In the news on Tuesday, Carl Levin, that's Senator from Michigan, wants to expand drone strikes in Pakistan. The first line says the top Senate Democrat on defense issues said on Tuesday he would like to see an expansion of the U.S. military's controversial drone strike operations in Afghanistan and Pakistan. So, I mean, that... this is a country, Pakistan, to which we give billions of dollars. They're always saying, well, they got to be careful because the United States is so unpopular in that country. I like that. We give them billions and we're unpopular. I mean, I can understand why. But this you would not expect from this kindly the liberal senator from Michigan, yet it is the subtitle of your book, right?
Yes, and it also, if we were to go back to last fall, which was when the Obama administration had its full-scale 4-week reconsideration of the Afghan war. I mean, one of the things that's very striking, and it relates to Levin now, is that all the options, you know, there was a fierce debate between the military and the president and Vice President Biden, who wanted to do something different than General McChrystal and General Petraeus wanted to do, and so on and so forth. There was an enormous debate, but the one thing about it was that every option had one word attached to it, which was more. There was either the more of the giant surge that they did, which was the counterinsurgency more, or there was the more of what Vice President Biden called counterterrorism plus, which was more trainers going in to train up the Afghan military, more drone attacks, more counterterrorism, so on and so forth. The one thing that's striking in Washington, and it doesn't matter whether you're talking about some right-wing senator or some, as you say, kindly liberal guy like Levin, the subtext is always more of something. In America, and this is one of the ways in which war has become the norm, in America, nobody ever thinks about less. Nobody really thinks about downsizing the mission. Peace of any sort is peace is just a word. It just has no meaning anymore.
Well, I see we're quickly running out of time, unfortunately, as well.
Yeah.
But so much of this is discussed on Tom Engelhardt's site, TomDispatch.com, where this is a continuing theme. But there's victory and then there's defeat. I mean, that's the way it's usually posed in the popular mentality. And it would sound like you, Tom Engelhardt, are defeatists. You want to snatch victory from, quote, our forces.
Well, what I would actually say is if you look at the U.S. military today, victory as a concept for the U.S. military no longer exists. I mean, when they talk about counterinsurgency, everybody, quote, agrees that we cannot defeat the Taliban. General Petraeus says this. You know, in other words, what is imagined is just an ongoing state of war of some sort in which we do somewhat better and so on. But there is no, you know, it's not a matter of stealing victory from someone or snatching defeat from the jaws of victory. For the American military, for American war making, there no longer is victory. It's just not a concept, I don't think.
So how do we get out?
Let me
just say that, you know, during the Vietnam era, finally everything got down to two words, out now. That was that was what it was. Will that work?
Well, I, I think some reasonable version of that, in fact, could work. I think part of the problem is that since we have never tried in any recent period any of the options that might involve the word out or withdrawal or whatever, not seriously, you know, we don't know how to get out. But I think the answer is, if you want your armies home, you can get them home. You can call in the neighbors. You can see what kind of peace negotiations you can get started. You can declare a truce. You can do many different things. But I think the basic decision is that you're going to bring your troops home, and you know that the Afghans have to work out their own problems. And if they work them out badly, and it takes them 50 or 60 years to work them out right, you know, we guard ourselves and do the best we can, but that we are not being safe for ourselves by putting billions and billions of dollars into that ongoing war, which is unwinnable.
Well, I want to thank you so much. Tom Engelhardt is the founder of TomDispatch.com. There'll be a link on my site as well if you missed that. Peter Werbe, Werbe.com. And Tom's new book is The American Way of War, How Bush's Wars Became Obama's. And I'll have a link to that as well. Tom Engelhardt, thank you. I would certainly tell people if they want to figure out what's going on, tremendous amount of information at your site. Thanks for being on the program.
And thank you so much, Peter.
Thank you for listening to Night Call on 101 WRIF. The views expressed on the program are not necessarily those of the staff, management, or ownership of WRIF Radio. Now, stay tuned for more Riff Rock on 101 WRIF Detroit.
Did you know that life insurance rates are near record lows? If you don't have coverage, listen to this. AccuQuote can help save you up to 70% on a term life policy that's right for you. Pick up the phone and call AccuQuote at 800-654-2075. AccuQuote has helped hundreds of thousands of people save a fortune on their life insurance. Here's how. AccuQuote monitors hundreds of top-rated life insurance products so you can get the lowest rates. For example, a healthy 40-year-old can buy $500,000 of 10-year level term for less than $21 a month. Rates for women are even lower. A short 5-minute call is all it takes. Call AccuQuote for a free life insurance quote at 800-654-2075. Rates, policy forms, and availability vary by state. Find out how much you can save on life insurance. Call AccuQuote for your free quote. 800-654-2075. That's 800-654-2075.
If you want a new computer but think you can't get credit, think again. Just call Tronics Country right now. No matter what your credit status is, now you can own a brand new desktop or laptop computer. Your approval is guaranteed as long as you have an active checking account and can afford small weekly payments. With Tronics Country, there's no credit check. You will not be turned down. Call right now and order your new computer. You'll also get a free color printer and a free digital camera. Just call 800-990-2258. But that's not all. Call right now and you'll also get a free 22-inch high-definition TV with your paid purchase. You heard right. A free TV with your new computer. All you need is an active checking account and your approval is guaranteed. Don't wait. Call Tronics Country right now. Call 800-990-2258. That's 800-990-2258. 800-990-2258.
101 WRIF.
Everything that rocks. Detroit's rock station. 101 WRIF.
The Riff.
My name's Rachel, and I'm 10 years old. I like riding my bike, playing soccer, and in 8 years, I'll be an alcoholic. I'll start drinking in middle school, just at parties. My friends will drink, so I will too.
Kids who drink before age 15 are 5 times more likely to have alcohol problems when they're adults.
My parents won't really know what's going on yet. I mean, I'll do okay in school, but when I drink, I'll do some things I don't really want to do. So by the time my parents talk to me about it, alcohol won't be my only problem.
Alcohol affects their judgment and their future. So start talking before they start drinking.
My parents won't believe it could happen to me.
For more information on teens and alcohol, and to learn what you can do, visit the web at stopalcoholabuse.gov. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, the Ad Council, and this station.
101
101 WRIF.
Yeah! Boom! Remember that?
Everything that rocks.